stereotypes.
I remember feeling sick by page 8, maybe.
A culture war about race, class, and who has the right to say what.
I do not think that I wrote in any way a racist book.
6 episodes considering different perspectives. Anatomy of a Cancellation from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of November. This is Tina Ritchie. Good morning. The government has confirmed it will announce in the coming week major changes to the criminal justice system in England and Wales, including a reduction in the number of trials by a jury. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, says once-in-a-generation reforms are needed to clear huge backlogs in courts. Here's our correspondent, Tom Simons.
The courts are dealing with a backlog that began during the COVID-19 pandemic. 80,000 cases are waiting to go in front of judges. Victims of crime, especially sexual crime, are much more likely to withdraw from the justice process if they're forced to wait. The government's plan is expected to focus on dispensing with juries in more cases, beyond those currently heard by magistrates, which can result in prison sentences of up to 2 years. Under the proposals, magistrates may be allowed to pass sentences of up to 5 years. Both the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats strongly oppose a move away from jury trials.
Sir Keir Starmer will give his backing to the Chancellor's budget in a speech tomorrow, after Downing Street dismissed claims that Rachel Reeves misled voters over the state of the economy as categorically untrue. The Conservatives have accused Ms Reeves of giving an overly pessimistic impression of the public finances as a smokescreen to raise taxes. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley has more details.
The Prime Minister will argue that the budget has set the economy on a better course, helping people with the cost of living and ensuring economic stability. Despite the Office for Budget Responsibility downgrading growth from next year, Sir Keir Starmer will argue growth has beaten forecasts and that investment in protecting public services will drive it in the future. The speech, just 5 days after the budget, suggests some nervousness that the government's economic plans may not have landed in the way ministers had hoped. Number 10 says it was always part of the plan to sell the budget.
Officials from Ukraine will meet the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Florida later to continue talks on the White House plan to end the conflict with Russia. The Ukrainian delegation will be headed by the country's National Security Council chief, Rustem Umerov. He's replaced Andriy Yermak, who resigned as Kyiv's lead negotiator and President Zelensky's chief of staff after an anti-corruption raid on his home. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says the number of people killed as a result of Israel's military offensive in the territory in the past 2 years has passed 70,000. The deaths have continued despite a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas taking effect last month. Our correspondent James Cook reports from Jerusalem.
Israel launched its offensive in Gaza in response to the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on the 7th of October 2023, in which about 1,200 people were killed and 251 taken hostage. Since then, according to Gaza's health ministry, which is run by Hamas, 70,100 people have been killed in Gaza. Medics at the Nasser Military Hospital said the most recent victims were 2 children. The Israel Defense Forces told BBC News they had struck 2 suspects who had crossed the so-called yellow line, behind which Israeli troops agreed to retreat under a ceasefire brokered by the United States more than 7 weeks ago.
The inaugural party conference for what's currently known as Your Party will resume later, after yesterday showed apparent divisions between the movement's co-founders, Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. Ms Sultana boycotted the first day of the event, saying the fledgling left-wing party had a toxic culture. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The name of the party will be unveiled by Jeremy Corbyn this evening. It could change from Your Party to Our Party or the Popular Alliance. But any alliance, whether formal or informal, has been fraying. Zara Sultana didn't attend yesterday's opening day because of the exclusion or expulsion of some members who'd retained their membership of other left-wing groups. Officials for Your Party said they were simply enforcing existing rules, and delegates will have an opportunity to change these today. There will also be a decision on whether the new party should have a single leader or if it should be run by a committee led by someone who isn't an MP.
The Pope is travelling from Turkey to Lebanon to begin the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church. Over the next 3 days, he'll meet Lebanon's leaders and lead a mass at the waterfront in Beirut that's expected to be attended by 12,000 people. Britain's Lando Norris will clinch his first Formula One World Championship today if he wins the Qatar Grand Prix. The McLaren driver will start the penultimate race of the season with a 22-point lead over his teammate Oscar Piastri. BBC News.
This is BBC Radio 4. In one of his final official acts before he died, Pope Francis put Antoni Gaudí, Spain's most famous architect, onto the path to sainthood. In a few moments, we'll hear from those who've been campaigning on Gaudí's behalf. Heart and Soul is next on Radio 4. Meanwhile, on BBC Sounds, you can discover a collection of stories that shaped our world and history.
A relentless fight for justice.
From the day I met Jimmy, I thought he was innocent.
Secrets buried for generations.
I could tell there was something slightly different about my dad from other dads.
A mission beyond the limits of courage.
I want to be one of the guys that goes back to rescue him.
Powerful documentaries from Radio 4's History Podcast, the home of The Fort, The Magnificent O'Connors, and The House at Number 48.
She'd waited for us for 50 years to turn up. This was part of her life story, and who am I to take it away?
The History Podcast from Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
A little later this hour, we'll visit an organic farmer in Lincolnshire. Having built it up from scratch, Hannah Thorogood's farm is now under threat. It's in the middle of land earmarked for a giant reservoir. On Your Farm is at 6:34. But now on Radio 4, Heart and Soul. Max Horbury investigates how Antoni Gaudí became God's architect.
Querido Antonio Gaudí, acompáñanos desde el cielo en nuestro camino de cada día. Ayúdanos a vivir nuestro trabajo con amor y reflexión para que podamos comprender la sabiduría que Dios nos revela a través de la creación.
María Teresa de los Ángeles is a nun in Cádiz, in the south of Spain. And almost every day she prays to the architect, Antoni Gaudí. His unusual buildings are some of the most famous in Spain. You might know him as the architect behind the Sagrada Familia, the enormous basilica in Barcelona, which is still under construction after more than 140 years. To some, he's known as God's architect. And right now, a committee in the Vatican is deciding whether this architect will be made a saint. Pope Francis, in one of his last official acts before he died, put Gaudí on the path to sainthood. I'm Max Horbury. And on this episode of Heart and Soul, which explores approaches to spirituality from around the world, I'm in Barcelona, in Spain's northern region of Catalonia. I'm here to understand why Spain's most famous architect could very well become a saint.
En la oscuridad de nuestro tiempo herido por la guerra y el sufrimiento. Querido Antonio Gaudí, cuídanos e intercede por nosotros ante Dios. Amén. Yo le hablo como si fuera un amigo.
I talk to him like he's a friend. A friend in the sky. A friend in heaven. More than anything, that's my relationship with him. A dialogue.
But why do you pray to Gaudí of all people?
Pues no lo sé bien. Es una buena pregunta.
Well, I really don't know. It's a good question. There's a theory that the saints choose us as well, in order to make a connection from heaven to earth. I knew only that he helped architects, and I wanted to ask on behalf of a friend of mine who's an architect. And when I felt listened to, I became interested in his life. Then I fell in love with his work and his art and his way of being. And that's how I began this sort of relationship between heaven and earth.
María Teresa de los Ángeles praised the Gaudí despite having never visited Barcelona or any of his buildings.
No, no he podido.
Pues en ese caso es un poco interesante que sí. Elegiste rezar a él.
Sí, es muy particular.
What would it mean for Gaudí to be made a saint?
Creo que puede cambiar mucho la visión que tenemos de la.
I think our idea of holiness can change. We can understand that it's not just related to the cloisters or the church. And in fact, lay people and professional people, artists, also have that holiness in their way of living. And whatever aspect of human life can be full of holiness.
Cualquier aspecto de la vida humana puede llevar a la plenitud de la santidad.
No te puedo comprender. Corazón loco.
I've come to the Gothic Quarter of Barcelona. It's one of the oldest parts of the city. It's also now one of the most touristy. And I'm standing in front of the Cathedral of Barcelona. It's a reminder of that typical Gothic style you see across Europe. In fact, at the very front, there's a particular seat where Gaudí would sit and pray, and from that position, if you look at the stained glass window, there is one very small panel that actually has a striking resemblance to the main towers of the Sagrada Familia. I've come here to meet with Archbishop of Barcelona, Cardinal Juan José Omeya. He now heads the official association that is working towards Gaudí's sainthood and liaises with the Vatican.
El santo se convierte en un modelo creíble, reconocible.
The saint becomes a model, believable, real, recognizable, valued by everyone, so that his life can help us. Any layman can be a saint because it's from the same nature as Gaudí. He's a professional, he's an architect, he's a scientist, he lives a life of prayer. And that's in the reach of everyone. He lives a professional life, and we all have a profession. But in addition to that, he's serving the poor. And those three things are what gives us the path to sainthood for all of us. And he lives it, and he becomes a role model from the 20th century for all of us.
One of the qualifying elements that the Vatican will be examining in the case of Gaudí's sainthood is whether there have been any miracles. There have been many testimonies of people who have prayed to Gaudí and found employment, cures to their medical ailments, and any variety of spiritual guidance. Some have been so moved by his work, they have converted to Catholicism. So, to understand why Gaudí is on the path to sainthood, we have to look at the way he lived and what he created.
Las iglesias.
In churches, the teachings and the things they want to show, they usually have on the inside. Gaudí put it all on the outside. He puts the Bible on the outside. The first facade of the basilica is the birth of Jesus. The second facade is the passion and the death of our Lord. He also puts that on the outside. And why does he put it all on the outside? He says, I put it on the outside so that anyone who doesn't want to go inside or doesn't have a faith can ask himself, why? He's evangelizing. This is an evangelist. This is a saint. He shows, but he doesn't oblige. He suggests. He invites. It's respectful of the faith of others. He invites you so that you can discover what he has discovered.
No obliga, pero invita a que descubras lo que él ha descubierto.
Depending on what time of day you walk into the Sagrada Familia, the church will be illuminated in a different colour. The stained glass windows on the eastern side are a mixture of cool blues and greens. It almost makes it look as if you're underwater. Millions of people every year from all over the world and from all different backgrounds enter through the Nativity facade and are overwhelmed by colour.
I don't really know what I expected. It's just like another building. And I just started crying because it was really out of beauty. I thought that the inside of this church was the most beautiful thing I ever saw, I think.
In the afternoon, the western windows bathe the basilica in a fiery red or yellow.
As I walked through the doors, I started weeping, like full ugly crying in this church. I'm not a religious person. And I just stood at the back of this church and cried. I couldn't believe that humans could imagine and create something so breathtakingly beautiful.
And when you look up, the columns go up and up and then split off like branches of a tree. And they hold up a ceiling adorned with what look like bursts of sun.
Me quedé sin palabras. Me sentí.
I was speechless. I was inside some man-made forest, an enormous forest. It was the feeling of being both inside and being a spectator. The enormous columns and the light, which is so beautiful. It's overwhelming.
Es como que sobrecogedor.
The otherworldly feeling is slightly undone by the constant sound of drilling and hammering that echoes through the space. It has been under construction since 1882. Gaudi's vision was so expansive and so ambitious that he knew well that he would never live to see more than a fraction of its completion. So what makes his architecture so special? Jordi Faulí is the head architect at the Sagrada Familia.
Yo creo que Gaudí conocía mucho el alma. Gaudí knows a lot the soul of the people, and he was thinking in the soul, was thinking in the other people when he was designing his different buildings.
So he was thinking of people's souls while designing, right?
I thought that he not only was thinking in the space, was thinking in the client, he was thinking in the people that in the future will look his works. He wanted that the people feel something in his heart, seeing or living in his works, his buildings.
And I mean, people do feel something. I mean, it's, you know, whether you're religious or not, when you walk in it, it has an impact.
I think he was a complete architect, like few have been in the history of architecture. When I say complete, he was an architect who had a command of structures, a command of materials, that had an extraordinary command of light, of colour. He made an architecture that was new, looking to the future, that would help lift people's spirits.
And what will it mean, do you think, if he becomes a saint?
He would be the first architect saint. And this is important for architects and for believers. And for everyone it's important, in the sense that it's not just the architecture. There has to be a life behind it, which the church believes is holy.
But how did his faith influence his way of working?
Gaudi, I think, understood there are certain patterns in nature which repeat.
Gijs van Hensbergen, Gaudi's biographer and author of a book about the Sagrada Familia.
If you have the Fibonacci sequence going on in things like sunflowers, and you can see these patterns and repeats going, and you realise that nature is hugely complex, but actually there are rhythms and patterns, then there has to be someone behind this. I think he understands that there is such beauty and perfection in works of creation that he has to try and imitate that as an architect. And the key, almost leitmotif of his work, is the use of gravity, the catenary arch, holding a chain, making it do that kind of egg shape, inverting that, and creating the most powerful form in existence. It's almost its own flying buttress. And I think that was where Gaudi suddenly realized you are working with God and God is working through you because gravity was invented by God.
Antonio Gaudi tiene una mirada muy contemplativa de la naturaleza que la plasma en sus obras.
Cardinal Juan José Omeya.
Y para él la naturaleza es de alguna manera.
Antoni Gaudi had a very contemplative vision of nature, which he puts in his work. The great architect of the world, he says, is God. And God talks to us through nature. And he realized that. In the Cathedral of Barcelona, he would sit in a little spot, meditating and writing and drawing. So his great masterpiece, the Basilica of the Sagrada Familia, he creates in contemplation, in prayer. But he doesn't stay alone in a personal prayer. He makes it for the benefit of others. He says, workers are in the image of God, and I have to help them so that they can eat and educate their children. And so, what does he do? He gives a salary to his workers, and he builds for them a small school so that their children can learn, and in the future, they too can have a profession. That is social action, but it comes out of a contemplation of God and of seeing that God is in the poor, and you have to serve God through the poor.
Cristo, ten piedad.
Cristo, ten piedad.
I'm Max Horbury, and I'm in Barcelona for Heart and Soul to find out why the architect Antoni Gaudí could be made a saint. The outside of the Sagrada Familia is pretty overwhelming. When you look at it, it's hard to let your eyes settle on any one thing for too long. It's overflowing with detail, telling the entire story of the Christian faith. Ever present, of course, is scaffolding, netting, and cranes slowly twirling overhead. At ground level, there are giant slabs of concrete and stone. There are models in mosaics, and men in hard hats busying themselves before the worst of the Spanish sun forces them to stop. In June 2026, after countless delays, the main tower of the Basilica is due to be completed, just in time for the 100-year anniversary of Gaudí's death. But it will be a long time still before the whole Sagrada Familia is finished. Gaudí's architecture, impressive as it is not the only reason he's been considered for sainthood. It is also how he lived. So who was the man, Antoni Gaudí? Born in 1852 in Reus, then Catalonia's second largest city, he came to Barcelona to study architecture and quickly stood out. One teacher is reported to have said he was either a genius or a madman. But how Gaudí, aged only 31, took over the design and construction of the Sagrada Familia is something of a miraculous story in itself. A year into the project, the man in charge, José María Bocabella, fired his first architect and went searching for a new man.
In the middle of the night, he has this dream where he's going to see a man with ginger hair and blue eyes, and who's going to come to the, you know, be the saviour of the Sagrada Familia project.
Gijs van Hensbergen, Gaudi's biographer and author of a book about the Sagrada Familia.
And the next day he goes to the studio of Martorell, and there in the back he sees a ginger-haired, blue-eyed man focusing, as Gaudí always did, with absolute kind of obsessive attention to detail. Well, this is an architect who hasn't done nothing of his own apart from design his desk, his visiting card, and assisted other architects. And suddenly he's launched into the largest building project of the 19th, 20th, and now the 21st century.
So who is Gaudí at that moment? I mean, paint me a little bit of a picture of, you know, who he was at this particular moment in time.
Well, when he was at university, he would use his brother to wear in his shoes for him, for instance. I mean, dandy, and I wouldn't go as far as Oscar Wilde, but certainly he was someone who would go to the opera, would be seen around. Apparently he fell in love as a young man with a woman, but he is so slow that she's already married by the time he asks her out for a coffee. But I think for him, the most profound and shocking thing, and I think this is one of the first crises that starts leading towards a far deeper and profound architect, is in 1876. Within months, his elder brother dies. His mother dies just months later. And Gaudi learns something which is going to become fundamental, I think, in his philosophy of life, which is that suffering and going through suffering like Christ, it's both cathartic, but it's also something which kind of crystallizes, and what comes out at the other end has been purified through suffering.
And so does this inform how he approaches the Sagrada Familia?
I think, you know, there are rumours, of course, that he was slightly anti-clerical in his youth. Well, which student isn't? But so what? I mean, in the end, what comes out, and I think begins to start happening, is when he gets that commission of the Sagrada Familia, he's beginning a long life's learning curve, both of architecture and of faith. And it deepens, and it deepens, and it deepens. And he's very lucky because immediately he's invited to the top table. He now knows all the bishops in Catalonia. He's friends with them. He sits at their table. He debates. He argues. He learns. He listens. He reads his Bible. He reads his Life of the Saints on a daily basis. I mean, he was someone who was led a very monastic life. Off in the evening, every evening to confession in St. Philippe Neri, down in the Bari Gothic. And then he'd come back. He'd be on his own. Maybe have supper with the local priest, Monsengil Perez. But apart from that, it would be straight back to the drawing board, muddling with little models. There's nothing I can see in his character, nothing I can see in his architecture, which would suggest anything else but pure devotion and someone who was thinking of remapping, in a sense, what the possibilities of architecture are.
Although he designed and built many other buildings, Gaudi worked on the Sagrada Familia for more than 40 years until his death. On June 7th, 1926, Gaudi finished work for the day and said to one of his workers, "Come early tomorrow. We're going to make beautiful things." He walked from the Basilica to the Gothic Quarter for his daily confession, and on the way, he crossed the road and was hit by a tram. He was dressed so shabbily, he was mistaken for a homeless person and left to bleed on the side of the road. He died 3 days later in hospital, aged 73. It's its own miracle that work has continued on the Sagrada Familia. During the Spanish Civil War, anarchists broke in and destroyed Gaudi's models, drawings, and instructions. And despite wars, dictatorships, multiple governments, and changing fashions, work on the Sagrada Familia has continued. But how will the Vatican decide whether Gaudi will be made a saint?
Cuando mucha gente proclama, dice que
When many people say that this man died and lived in a saintly way, we begin a process of studying if it's true.
Cardinal Juan José Omeya.
For that, we create a group of people, historians, theologians, and scientists who study his life, his work, and they present their findings to the Vatican, and it's then studied in the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. They decide whether there is a virtue of saintliness in this man. And if so, the Pope declares him venerable. For the next level, which will be declared blessed, there has to be a miracle. And we have a miracle presented to us by a father on behalf of his son who is ill in the Netherlands. And the doctors say that, surprisingly, he's been cured. And so they have to study that in the Vatican. They get a commission of scientists and doctors who will examine it. And if they decide that this really has been a miracle, because this cure isn't explained by human means or by medicine, then they present it to the Pope. And the Pope says, "I recognize this miracle and will declare him blessed." And then there would be another step, which would be sainthood, for which there would need to be one more miracle. So minimum two miracles in order to be a saint.
Pope Francis declared Gaudi venerable just before he died, the first step towards sainthood. Now for Gaudi to become a saint, it's a matter of miracles. I'm meeting José Manuel Almuzara in a café by the Sagrada Familia. It's busy with men from the construction site who are having a quick coffee on their break. Since 1992,
he has been campaigning for Gaudi's sainthood and collecting testimonies of those who have prayed to Gaudi or had a spiritual experience.
I once took a group to the Sagrada Familia. We entered the church, and then suddenly I hear someone shouting, "José Manuel, José Manuel." I turn around and say, "What's going on?" There was an older man. He was saying, "But I'm an atheist. What's happening to me?" He was very emotional. His eyes were teary because he was thinking, "If I'm an atheist, how can it be that I'm so moved by this architecture and this church? It's not possible." So I gave him a hug and I said, "Of course, beauty is for all of us, whether we are atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, Catholics, Protestants. There are people who have prayed for work, and Gaudí has helped them find it. People who are unable to have children. There was one woman in Italy who prayed, and then she was blessed. There was a Korean man who had come to Barcelona and said, "I came as a Buddhist, and I went home to South Korea wanting to be Catholic." Why? Because seeing Gaudí's work, I saw a divine touch, and that was there with the assistance of God. Incredible.
Why do you think that Gaudí is deserving of sainthood?
I think in this world we need a guide, a teacher, and I think that Gaudí brings those things together. He can be a role model of holiness, a person who lived in his own circumstances, accepted God and wanted to do good, and I think that's a message that today, in the 21st century, is something that can help me and everyone.
María Teresa de los Ángeles, the nun in Cádiz who prays to Gaudí. When you pray to him, what do you pray for?
Well, I ask on behalf of other people. I ask him about specific issues. I know, for example, he really liked to help the poor and the unemployed. And so occasionally I have asked him to help find work to someone I know. And they found it, you know?
Yo le rezo y le hablo. Le pido ayuda.
I pray to him and I speak to him. I ask for help. And I try to imitate him too. The example he led by, searching for beauty and through beauty, trying to bring others closer to God and find God in that beauty.
Y a través de la belleza intentar acercar a los demás a Dios también, ¿no? O encontrar a Dios en la belleza.
What do you think it means then that he expressed his faith through his architecture, through his art?
Creo que es la manera que Dios nos regaló precisamente para manifestar.
I think it is exactly the gift that God has given us in order to manifest the elements of the soul. The mystic saints, Saint Teresa, Saint John of the Cross, always needed to use images, poetry, music in order to express, because God is ineffable. To communicate an experience with God, it's of a beauty, of a type of beauty that is very difficult to describe with words. And so to use art to express the ethereal, the divine, has always been the way for man to express these things of the soul. And the interesting thing with Gaudí is that, as a genius, he knows how to find symbols that connect with him, but also allow others to connect. It's sort of a universal language of the spiritual life and the beauty of God, you know? Through the light, through the color, through the size and the forms, it's really beautiful what Gaudí does.
A través del color, a través del tamaño, de las formas. Es muy bonito lo que hace Gaudí.
It could still take many years for Gaudí to be declared a saint. But for the man who designed the Sagrada Familia, there's no rush.
Heart and Soul was presented and produced by Max Horbury.
The stories we tell
about the people we know
and the places we love
are not just made here,
their stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What?
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Now on Radio 4, Rebecca Rooney is in a very windy Lincolnshire for On Your Farm.
I remember this bell on my grandparents' farm that was, so my mum's kind of childhood farm, that when my granny wanted my granddad, she would ring the bell because you didn't have text messages, did you? You didn't have phone calls and things. And so I love the sound of that bell. So, yeah, I'll leave that there. One thing that I've started doing on the farm tours I really like is just having a little kind of go-round to introduce each other to...
I'm here in Lincolnshire at Screddington, surrounded by flat, open farmland as far as the eye can see. The sun's out, so's the wind. Doesn't seem to bother the cattle, though. I'm here to meet Hannah Thorogood, who's built up an organic farm, a farm business from scratch. She owns 18 acres, rents several hundred more. But her farm and the fields all around here are right in the path of plans for a giant reservoir.
Okay, so welcome to the farm. You're on a blustery cold day like today. Thank you for coming. So this is the ink pot. The reason that we call it the inkpot is the shape of the house across the road. Our house is a typical Lincolnshire farm worker's cottage that, you know, just a little rectangle with a triangle on top. So the whole house is 8 metres by 8 metres wide. Wow. So I often stand in people's living rooms and go, this is the size of our whole house. But it does look like a little bit like an inkpot. Let's go out and go and have a look down at the cows. As we go through... the electric fence is on. We do have cows in the field. We do have wild turkeys in the field that are not adhering to what they should be adhering to at the moment. So just watch out as we're walking around.
Hannah, today you began your busy day with a tour. Why do you invite people onto the farm? Why do you have these open days once a month?
Oh, who knows? I don't know. I absolutely love. I think there's something really intrinsic about connecting people with their food and connecting people with farms.
You haven't inherited this farm. You've built this business yourself from scratch.
Yeah, so although I was raised by a mum who was raised on a farm, I actually grew up in the middle of town. So I grew up on the A6 in Bedford and right in the middle of town. And mum would have always liked to have brought us up on a farm, but it just didn't happen that way. And so when my sister and I left home, mum then went and got her own farm as a retirement thing. And so 15 years ago, I set up this. And at that time, I had my husband, but for 10 years, I've been doing it on my own with the girls, so single parent farming. I'd already gone off and worked in lots of places and had a bit of money in a house and worked hard to pay off the mortgage on that, and very, very privileged, had some money from other parts of the family as well, and so managed to buy this, which is 18 acres and a very, very small house.
And you've got the stock, you've got your cattle. How many head of cattle?
So we have 55 head of cattle across two different herds. So we have the Lincoln Red herd here, and then we've got another herd of Dexter cattle.
And then you've got sheep?
Yeah, we've got 200 sheep. So they're a mixture of different native breeds. So really hardy. They really thrive on a low input system.
And you obviously couldn't have all this livestock on the land you own.
Yeah, so I own this 18 acres. I have some kind of reservations about whether anyone can actually ever own land. I feel that we look after the land for the next generation. But I'm also a tenant farmer on lots of other fields, and we have 8 different landlords.
And your daughters are also following you into your passion for farming.
Yeah, so they were part of the farm from when they were 3. We moved here, and they've been equal decision makers on the farm since then, which is really important. And that's a really core part of who we are as a farm, that the children have always got to have part of the decision making.
And Hannah, you're in your shirt sleeves.
Yeah, I'm in my T-shirt. I come from a long line of people that don't feel the cold. On the market stands that I do, there's a few traders that say, if I put my jumper on, then it's like, boy, it must be cold.
Hannah, I can see the cattle.
So we've got Lincoln Reds, and they're 100% pasture fed, so with Pasture for Life. But I work for Pasture for Life as well. We have quite often farmer groups coming to this farm to show people regenerative methods of farming.
What is Pasture for Life? What does that mean?
So Pasture for Life is a fantastic organisation that works with farmers to help to kind of realise the power in our pasture. People can be certified to have their cows and their sheep to be 100% pasture fed, so they only ever eat pasture. So that's fresh grass, meadow, hay, and silage. And so
no concentrates, no cake.
Yeah, absolutely, no concentrates.
How have you managed that when it's been such a difficult, dry year in terms of grazing and fodder?
Yeah. So our grass that you see at the moment is much shorter than it would normally be. Hold on, Sarah Louise, are they coming into here? So if we go over this side, folks.
Oh, watch the electric fence.
Thank you.
So what's happening right now is behind us, the cows are noisy because they want to be moved onto this area. So we do a thing called adaptive multi-paddock grazing. So Sarah Louise, who works here, she's our full-time farm worker. Then she's going to show moving the cattle. So what we have here is a herd of noisy Lincoln Red cattle. They're a very rare subset of Lincoln Red. And because they're Lincoln Red, they're obviously really well suited to here.
They're really pretty. They're like this deep, russety brown. Yeah. And they're kind of kicking their legs. They're really frisky and excited.
Yeah, absolutely. If you see the calves, they've got their tails high. Have you heard the expression hightailing it? That's where it comes from. So these calves are literally hightailing it across the field and having fun. Now, this grass is really, really short compared to what we'd normally graze. But it's been such an incredibly dry year. We've just not had the grass growth that we've needed. So most herds around us have been needing to be fed their winter rations already. We've managed to hold off from doing that, but because we do these daily moves.
Sarah Louise, you got the job of moving the cattle. And why'd you do it?
So the mob grazing, or some call it amp grazing now, it's about moving them on regularly to manage the land better. And the better the land is, the better the animals are. So we have a really lovely rotation going, and the land just gets lovely amounts of rest, and it can do so much more because of that.
So every day you cordon off a separate strip of pasture and just move the herd on?
Yeah, every day we do that. We've got two herds of cattle, and we do it with the sheep when they're in fields that are suited to it as well.
And they look quite a frisky, lively bunch. How tricky is it moving them?
Not at all. They know exactly what they're doing. It's a system that most of them have been born into, and they've done it every day of their life.
But they're quite excited to get a new bit of grass.
Always. We're always excited about food, aren't we?
So you can see the size of the trees. These are all ones that we've planted. And that's for create that shelter belt. And then a little bit further down there, we've got the beehives. We ended up with a kind of a total team of women on the farm. I didn't really mean to. I did have a husband, just decluttered. But he lost a bit of weight. So we've got Angela with her bees and her daughter Emma, and then we've got Cheryl, who makes all our jams and chutneys and does all our emails. There's me and my two daughters. So one of my daughters is off in Australia at the moment, and then Martha, who's just got back from uni last night to be here today, my mum, and then Sarah Louise, who works here. And so it's a women run and managed and done everything farm. So this is the forest garden,
and that's like an orchard. Can see the remains of the apples and currant bushes and things.
Yeah, so a forest garden is a permaculture example of lots of different perennial food styles occupying lots of different kind of heights. So instead of just having an orchard, which is a bit of a monoculture, we understory it with fruit bushes and with lots of diversity in there. So we've got apples and pears and plums and cherries and all sorts. And then we also have the red currants, black currants, rhubarb, perennial kales, ground covering raspberries, all sorts. So there's always something to eat from there, and it requires very little work. It's great.
What is permaculture?
Permaculture is a design system that you can apply to anything. It was originally applied to small farms and large farms in Australia, started in the 70s, but actually it's a design process that you can apply to absolutely everything. So the crux of permaculture is that it's based on three ethics. So that's earth care, doing everything you can do to look after the planet, but also people care, so looking after yourself, your kin and the wider community. And then it's also this third ethic that talks about fair share. It's just looking at how much do you need to take, how much of the earth's resources do you need to take.
And you're a permaculture demonstration farm.
Yeah, so part of having the open days is that people can come along and learn what permaculture is. I'm a permaculture teacher. I've been teaching permaculture for 20 years. We run courses here, we run events here, 10-day courses, 12-day courses. So everything that we sell in the shop is from the farm.
So, are you going to pay by card or by cash?
I'll pay by card.
Okay, right, let me make this card reader work. Well, that's 1740 then, please. Pop that on there, and it should work.
We'll just press the card reader, Mum.
Yep.
She's our Saturday girl, she does very well, doesn't she?
Thank you. And then you'd like these ones. Mm-hmm.
And so you're Hannah's mum?
I am, yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
You're busy on your open Saturdays, your open days?
Yes, I just come up once a month just to give her a hand, because I've got a small farm down in Bedfordshire, so I sort of leave someone else in charge there and come up here and give her a hand.
She's my best Saturday girl, she is. She comes up at 81. She comes up and, pardon?
80.
80, at 80, I'm so sorry, she'll nearly be 81. She's got her own farm, she's got her own herd of Dexters, and then she comes up, helps me out, and then goes home and sorts out all her animals, so she's a good girl. Yeah.
And what are the best sellers in the shop?
I think the meat, and generally the eggs, but she hasn't got many eggs at the moment because the hens have gone off lay. Jams are always popular, and then sometimes people come in and buy lots of wool, because her wool is all from her own flock, and it's just natural colours, so that gets very popular sometimes.
And then over here we've got our refreshment stall, and so we've got our lovely ink pot pulled beef baps with coleslaw, teas and coffees, hot chocolates, herbal teas, all served up by Martha. Help yourself.
Thank you.
So I'm with Martha. You run the farm with your mum, and you're also a student. You're studying zoology. What are you hoping to kind of achieve here at Inkpot Farm?
Well, I've lived here since I was three, so it's kind of, I fell in love with it all as I was growing up. So I know it's what I want to do with my life. You know, I'll either do it here or somewhere else in the future, depending on how things go with Anglian Water. But I just try and show people that there are better ways to farming than just, you know, battery hens or inside all the time. I like to show people that there's a better side of farming than what they see sometimes on TV.
And of course, you've got a twin sister. She's in Australia at the moment. Right. And your mum said that's where she got a lot of her first passion about the way she farms here.
Yeah, so around when the time my mum went to uni, she went travelling around the world, and she spent a lot of time in Australia and New Zealand, and she learned a lot of different ways of farming that we do sometimes implement here that work with the land, and it really inspired her. Her kind of life's purpose now is to feed people good food that feeds the planet at the same time. So she finds all these amazing ideas and ways to make sure that we're feeding the soil and the people and all the animals really well all the time. It's just inspirational, really.
I'm thinking it's a bit windy. Should we go in the lee of the shelter? Right,
we've got some pigs in here.
Oh, you've got some pigs in there as well?
They're just pet pigs. They're Sarah Louise's pet pigs.
Oh.
So if you step over, you'll be fine.
So we're just getting out the winds.
And we're coming in here where we've got a couple of pigs. One completely hidden under hay in there. And they're having a lovely time. You can just see a very happy snout sticking out underneath there.
So funny. And so your daughters are a really important part of the business. And that gets you thinking to the future. You have showed us around the farm, but your farm is right in the middle of plans for a big reservoir.
Yeah, a huge reservoir. So Anglian Water wrote to us 3 years ago to let us know very kindly of their plans that it would affect 4,500 acres around here, of which we're right in the middle. There won't be a decision, a result, you know, from the developmental consent order until 2030. So we've already lived under it for 3 years and we've got another 5 years before we'll know whether this farm has a future or not.
And is it looking pretty certain that this is going to be the site where the reservoir will be created?
This is the site that they are working on. So if you drive in and out, you'll see there's areas where they're doing surveying at the moment. They're doing archaeological surveys.
So if we're standing here, Hannah, and we're talking about the plans for the reservoir, I can see the trees that you planted around the field, but it would be pretty much as far as the eye could see, the water.
Oh, way beyond that. So this soil that we're standing on, so they would have to dig down 30 metres to remove all of this soil. It's not that we'd be flooded, because as you can see, we're not in a valley. So we'd be literally wiped off the face of the planet. It's an incredibly expensive way to try and store water. To dig down 30 metres is a phenomenal amount. You know, it's two double-decker buses deep and remove a trillion tonnes of soil and scraped back to the sides where they'd be creating an artificial landscape. So that's one of the major parts. It's economically unviable to create an artificial reservoir like that on such a colossal scale. There's plenty of empty valleys. If you want to store water, you plug up the end of a deep empty valley with a stream going through it. Here they're going to have to recreate a river to bring water here to us. There's so many flaws in this design, it's ridiculous.
Just by their nature, reservoirs are unnatural. They're a man-made infrastructure way of coping with the population's demand for water. And, you know, is there such a thing as an empty valley?
Yeah, no, there are. We've mapped out some and told Anglian Water. We've shown them the maps of where they are. And there's plenty. If the kind of call went out, there would be farmers with pretty much empty valleys, with valleys without houses in them, that would be happy to, you know, be paid handsomely for their valley.
With climate change, water security is becoming more pressing for us, and we haven't got enough water. A reservoir's got to go somewhere, and this, with all their research, all the money they've invested, spent years and millions finding the best site, it's got to go somewhere.
Absolutely, and I totally agree we need better water security across this country, but reservoirs aren't necessarily the best idea for doing that, and specifically this reservoir. What they haven't calculated, when I talked to the chief engineer about it, this is going to be a very wide reservoir and relatively shallow, with no big landscape features either side of it to protect it from the wind. And so there'll be a huge amount of evaporation off this reservoir.
And strategically, the government says we've not built a reservoir for 30 years. We need that national infrastructure. What's the answer, if not a reservoir like this, to make sure that households do have enough drinking water?
So one of the answers is we need to use less. We've got very, very extravagant with water. There's a lot of re-education about water management that needs to happen. So one aspect is the demand side. The other side is the whole landscape design, the landscape that we use. So we often see housing being built on flood meadows and people gravelling and tarmacking their driveways. So we need to rethink that in terms of water absorption. And then us farmers also need to play our part, because we can absorb so much water into our fields and into our landscapes. We can hold back that water and let it percolate down and recharge the aquifers. So if we as farmers also play our part by reducing our compaction, by increasing our organic matter and reducing our chemical inputs, we can really hold much, much more water in our landscape.
Those are ideal, sensible things to do. But in terms of expediency, that's not going to generate the amount of water that a reservoir like this one would so quickly. It looks like it's coming. What will that mean for you? What will you do?
It'll be utter destruction. We'll lose our house and our land and everything. That's the same for the over 100 people around here would lose their houses or their land or both. And it will be a community completely ripped apart. We'll lose our community. And, you know, the children moved here when they were three. This is the only home they ever remember.
And in practical terms, will there be a compulsory purchase order? Would you be given enough monies to go and buy a plot of land and try and start over?
Yeah, and this would come down to like a lot of negotiation, because I think people have quite a naive idea that when you have compulsory purchase, you end up some millionaire with a, you know, a huge house somewhere. But you just have to look at the mess that's happened with HS2 and how many people have yet to be compensated. People have been pushed off their land. We would be compensated, but if you think when you move onto a farm, when you start a farm, you spend as much money on developing the farm as you do buying the land in the first place. So if we were just given the value of our land, we'd actually be 15 years behind where we are now. You can't just pick up an organic permaculture demonstration farm and start with a blank canvas and be where, you know, this has taken 15 years to get where we are.
And so what are you going to do?
Cry. No. If it goes ahead, I still think there's a very strong chance that it won't go ahead, because it is just such a fundamentally ridiculous design. If it does go ahead, then we'd need to relocate, but the decision has already been moved back 3 years in the 3 years that we've known about it. So I think, like so many big projects like this, the time frame on this will just go on and on and on, and decisions we pushed back. So it could be that I never see anything happen in my lifetime, but it doesn't actually get rejected. It's a strange situation to be living under.
This is such a lot to have hanging over you and your daughters, and yet you seem so positive. How are you managing to keep your pecker up like this?
Well, sometimes I don't. So, you know, you have to be really realistic about mental health and farming. We need to be able to talk to each other and have a good cry. And there are times I drive home and you can see the people digging up neighbours' farms for the surveying and the archaeological digs and all those kind of things. And I've pulled over and just had a big cry and not wanted to drive home because you don't know what you're coming to. So it's, you know, it's not always okay. But the thing is we've got a planet to save, and we can do that through good farming. And we've got a nutritional crisis that we can turn around through good farming. So, you know, my life's work is to help people to farm in a way that's closer to nature, that reduces their inputs, that's more economical, that can really nurture their customers and feed people and really fix a lot of the health problems that we face by good natural farming. To me, that's much more about what my life's about.
Hannah Thorogood, ending that episode of On Your Farm from Lincolnshire. It was produced and presented by Rebecca Rooney. Next week, On Your Farm travels to the American Midwest and discovers an award-winning ranch. We'll find out why at 6:35 next Sunday morning. A weather update now. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, John, and good morning. We're between weather systems today, so yesterday's low pressure clearing off to the east. Another area of low pressure sweeps in from the west through tonight, and that's going to bring particularly heavy rain. In fact, we've got an amber warning in force from midnight tonight for South Wales. But in between those two weather systems, for many of us today looks dry and bright, more sunshine than recent days, lighter winds, but quite a chilly start. So the detail first for southeast England through the Midlands into eastern England. It is pretty chilly out here first thing. Temperatures not far off freezing in a few spots, so it could be a touch of frost first thing, but plenty of dry weather today. Blue skies around, light winds too. Not particularly warm, 7 to 9 degrees our top temperature. Meanwhile, a bit further north, so across northern England, eastern Scotland and northern Scotland, we've still got a few showers around, and they are wintry for the Grampians, the southern uplands, Cumbrian fells as well. So could be a bit of ice over the next few hours with those wintry showers falling on cold surfaces. They ease away, though, fairly quickly. The winds ease from the east as well. And then it's looking largely dry for much of the day. Some sunshine, still pretty chilly, just 2 or 3 for parts of northeast Scotland, 5 or 6 for northern England. Meanwhile, further west, so south-west England, Wales, south-west Scotland and Northern Ireland as well. Well, here we've got a few showers first thing, particularly for parts of Wales, also affecting the Isle of Man as well. There'll be on and off light showers through the day, but most places predominantly looking dry. Sunny spells and highs between about 7 to 11 degrees. But it's through tonight that heavy rain arrives from the west, and it's going to be pushing eastwards across all parts by the time we get to tomorrow morning. The wind's picking up from the southwest too, but the heaviest rain will be across the south of Wales. Here, an amber warning comes into force at midnight, and there could be 100, even 120 millimetres of rain tomorrow across the highest ground in the south of Wales. So needless to say, that could well cause some flooding, some heavy rain and some strong winds elsewhere in the west tomorrow too.
Thanks, Sarah. After the news, William Crawley will be here with Sunday. And a little later this morning at 8:10, it'll be Sunday Worship, which throughout Advent will be celebrating the works of literary greats from around the UK and reflecting on what they can tell us about this season of preparation. This morning, on this St Andrew's Day, we'll explore the work and spirituality of the great Scottish writer and poet Edwin Muir, tracing his developing faith and its influence on his writings. Sunday Worship comes live from the University of St Andrews at 8:10. Next Saturday on Radio 4, Anna Foster marks an anniversary of eyewitness reporting.
From our own correspondent at 70.
All that evening, Baghdad had been shaking.
I remember recognising Chairman Mao's brilliant...
In charge of this Aladdin's cave is a babushka.
I'm Anna Foster, and to celebrate seven decades of global reporting, I'll be talking to some familiar foreign correspondents.
And the soldier says, no, 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 no press. And Jeremy says, BBC. And the soldier looks at him and goes, Lise Doucette?
Including Lise Doucette, Jeremy Bowen, Steve Rosenberg, and Kate Adie.
Wow, what a fook I could write.
From our own correspondent at 70 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Saturday night at 8.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of November. Good morning. This is Tina Ritchie. The government will announce major reforms to the criminal justice system this week, including plans to cut the number of trials by jury. Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech to back the Chancellor's budget after Rachel Reeves was accused of misleading voters. Officials from Ukraine have travelled to Florida for talks with the US Secretary of State about ending the war with Russia. The government has confirmed it will announce in the coming week major changes to the criminal justice system in England and Wales, including a reduction in the number of trials heard by a jury. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, says once-in-a-generation reforms are needed to clear a backlog in courts where some cases are not due to be heard until 2030. Here's our correspondent, Tom Simons.
The courts are dealing with a backlog that began during the COVID-19 pandemic. 80,000 cases are waiting to go in front of judges. Victims of crime, especially sexual crime, are much more likely to withdraw from the justice process if they're forced to wait. The government's plan is expected to focus on dispensing with juries in more cases, beyond those currently heard by magistrates, which can result in prison sentences of up to 2 years. Under the proposals, magistrates may be allowed to pass sentences of up to 5 years. The government says magistrates' courts already decide 90% of cases and only 3% go in front of a Crown Court jury. Sources say the changes will be bold and played down reports that the plan set out in an internal Ministry of Justice briefing seen by the BBC last week will be watered down. Both the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats strongly oppose a move away from jury trials.
Sir Keir Starmer will give his backing to the Chancellor's budget in a speech tomorrow after Downing Street dismissed claims that Rachel Reeves misled voters over the state of the economy as categorically untrue. The Conservatives have accused Ms Reeves of giving an overly pessimistic impression of the public finances as a smokescreen to raise taxes. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley has more details.
The Prime Minister will argue that the budget has set the economy on a better course, helping people with the cost of living and ensuring economic stability. Despite the Office for Budget Responsibility downgrading growth from next year, Sir Keir Starmer will argue growth has beaten forecasts and that investment in protecting public services will drive it in the future. The speech, just 5 days after the budget, suggests some nervousness that the government's economic plans may not have landed in the way ministers had hoped. Number 10 says it was always part of the plan to sell the budget. The Prime Minister will also address the report this week which found the UK was the most expensive place in the world to build nuclear power. Sir Keir will highlight unnecessary red tape in the sector, saying an urgent correction is needed.
Officials from Ukraine will meet the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff in Florida later to continue talks on the White House plan to end the conflict with Russia. The Ukrainian delegation will be headed by the country's National Security Council chief, Rustem Umerov. He's replaced Andrei Yermak, who resigned as Kyiv's lead negotiator and President Zelensky's chief of staff after an anti-corruption raid on his home. The former US ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, says today's talks will shape Mr. Witkoff's approach to meetings in Moscow later this week.
He's going to see Vladimir Putin. He's the one who cooked up the very bad 28-point plan. Rubio corrected that into this plan that was done with Europeans and Ukrainians. But now it's Witkoff going back to Moscow again. So I think the whole point of the Ukrainian trip is to set some guardrails so that we know what Witkoff is actually going to say to the Russians.
The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says the number of people killed in Israel's military offensive has passed 70,000. Israel launched its action after attacks by Hamas on the 7th of October 2023, in which about 1,200 people were killed and 251 were taken hostage. The inaugural party conference for what's currently known as Your Party will resume later, after yesterday showed apparent divisions between the movement's co-founders, Jeremy Corbyn and Sarah Sultana. Ms. Sultana boycotted the first day of the event, saying the fledgling left-wing party had a toxic culture. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The name of the party will be unveiled by Jeremy Corbyn this evening. It could change from Your Party to Our Party, or to For the Many, or the Popular Alliance. But any alliance, whether formal or informal, has been fraying. Zara Sultana didn't attend yesterday's opening day because of the exclusion or expulsion of some members who'd retained their membership of other left-wing groups, such as the Socialist Workers' Party. Officials for Your Party said they were simply enforcing existing rules, and delegates will have an opportunity to change these today. There will also be a decision on whether the new party should have a single leader, which is likely to provoke a contest between Mr. Corbyn and Ms. Sultana, or if it should be run by a committee led by someone who isn't an MP.
The Pope is travelling from Turkey to Lebanon for the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church. Lebanon is religiously diverse and has the largest percentage of Christians in the Middle East. From Beirut, our correspondent Hugo Bashega reports.
Pope Leo's visit to Lebanon is being framed as an important national moment. Posters with pictures of the Pope decorate the streets of Beirut. And over the next 3 days, he will meet Lebanon's leaders, hold a silent prayer at the site of the deadly port explosion in 2020, and lead a mass at the waterfront that is expected to be attended by 12,000 people. The visit comes amid political and economic turmoil here and rising fears of a possible escalation of the Israeli attacks against the Shia Muslim movement Hezbollah. The group has welcomed the visit, describing Lebanon as a diverse social fabric. Given the recent warnings from Israel, some Lebanese have described the trip as the calm before the storm.
In Formula One, Britain's Lando Norris says he'll try everything to be crowned world champion at this afternoon's Qatar Grand Prix. The McLaren driver will clinch the title if he wins the race, although there are other scenarios that would lead him to victory, as our sports reporter Joe Linsky explains.
It's the penultimate race of the Formula One season, and Lando Norris knows he could be champion tonight. He's 22 points clear of McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri, and 25 ahead of Red Bull's Max Verstappen. On the track, the sums are simple. Win the Qatar Grand Prix, and Norris will be champion. He'll start it second on the grid, just behind Piastri. But Norris does have options. He could play it safe to take a decent lead into next week's finale in Abu Dhabi. Two third-place finishes will ensure he wins the title. Or he could go to seal it in Doha and become Britain's 11th F1 champion. At 26 years old, it's not a bad dilemma.
The fallout from Wednesday's budget continues to dominate the newspapers. The Sunday Times tells its readers the Prime Minister will intervene to shore up his Chancellor, who it describes as engulfed in a damaging row about whether she was honest with voters about the state of the economy. The Mail on Sunday says Rachel Reeves must resign for lying, referring to accusations she knew the OBR forecast on the economy was better than originally thought when she unveiled her financial plans. The Sunday Telegraph asserts that Sir Keir Starmer signed off the Chancellor's speech, which it describes as black hole lies, and declares that Ms. Reeves' career is on the brink and she could take Starmer down with her. In response, Downing Street said Ms. Reeves' comments were entirely accurate and that the Prime Minister was aware of the speech and the OBR's figures. Details of a Centre for Social Justice report are highlighted by the Sunday Express. It says families with three children need to earn £71,000 to bring in as much money as a similar household living on benefits. The think tank is quoted as warning that Britain is in a welfare crisis because of what it calls Rachel Reeves' benefit budget. The government said it's delivered a budget that cut debt, borrowing and the cost of living. The Sunday Times carries an interview with a worshipper who was accidentally shot by police as he barricaded the doors at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester to try to stop an attacker getting inside. Yoni Finlay is credited with saving countless lives last month. He tells the paper of the huge amount of guilt that he survived and how he's considering moving to Israel to keep his children safe because there is so much hate in the UK. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, Ukraine's ambassador to the UK, General Valery Zaluzhny, says his country has a chance to embrace political change after a peace deal is signed. Tipped as a future president, he also says Ukraine needs to rid itself of corruption and bring in reforms to prosper when the war is over. The death of the acclaimed playwright Sir Tom Stoppard features in many of the papers, with The Observer devoting its entire front page to a picture of him as a young man, along with the phrase, "Words, words, they're all we have to go on." The paper says he'll be remembered for his wit, irreverence and generosity of spirit. And that's a look at this morning's newspapers.
Read by Tina Ritchie. Now on Radio 4, it's Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. As you've just been hearing, Pope Leo is moving on from Turkey to Lebanon today in his first overseas tour. We'll be asking, what do those destinations tell us about the focus of his pontificate 6 months after he was elected?
We must strongly reject the use of religion for justifying war, violence, or any form of fundamentalism or fanaticism.
We'll also find out how the experience of Muslim football fans in the UK is changing with new prayer rooms, iftars and the England team's first Muslim player. And as you continue to celebrate your favourite hymns by sending us emails, we will talk to one of the world's most successful hymn writers about what it's like to create a liturgical banger.
We codenamed it the National Anthem of Christianity. That was the first hymn. We're going to call it, we codenamed it the National Anthem of Christianity. The melody was written on the back of a Northern Ireland electricity bill that I hadn't opened or paid.
The composer Keith Getty there. Your emails this morning to sunday@bbc.co.uk. It's been more than 30 years since the Church of England changed its rules to allow women to be ordained as priests. And we've recently seen the culmination of that journey for women with the appointment of the first female Archbishop of Canterbury. But in those three decades, the Church also witnessed an exodus of priests and bishops who joined the Catholic Church. According to a new study by St Barnabas Society and St Mary's University Twickenham, around 700 Anglican clergy, including 16 bishops, crossed the Tiber in that period, which amounts to quite a sizable source, actually, of Catholic vocations in that period. Let's talk to Father David Palmer, a former Anglican priest who became a Catholic, a member of the Catholic Church in the early 2000s, and the Church of England vicar, the Reverend Mark Wolverson. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you with us. Father David, actually, I stumbled there a little bit because when you switched from the Anglican Communion into the Catholic Church, there was a gap, wasn't there, before you became a priest in the Catholic Church?
Yes, that's right. When I first became a Catholic, I was a layman. I got a job as a lay chaplain in a prison for a few years. And then whilst I was already a Catholic, the Ordinariate was set up by Pope Benedict, and then I actually became a priest through that.
And you were married, of course, before making the switch from Canterbury to Rome. Did that form any kind of obstacle or difficulty?
Not so much in the Ordinariate. So, because the Ordinariate was specifically set up to help former Anglican clergy become part of the Catholic Church, and so they were much more geared up for married priests, because, of course, a lot of Anglicans are married, so yeah.
Why'd you do it? Why'd you make the move?
Yeah, so I mean, to put it, it's a big thing in many ways, lots of factors, but to try and put it more succinctly, there were three primary issues for me. One was to do with an increasing sort of sacramental understanding of the faith. Secondly, was to do with the universality of the Catholic Church. So, as a vicar, if I went to Spain or, you know, anywhere really outside of England, it was very, very hard to find a Church of England or an Anglican church, whereas I could go anywhere and find a Catholic church. So I became aware of just the sheer universality. And thirdly, it was an issue of authority. And I think for many people that come across, that's the underlying issue, including with the issue of ordination of women, which wasn't a presenting issue for me at the time. But looking back, I recognise that underlying people's issue with that is the issue of authority. Who gets to choose what the church believes?
And why the Church of England's taking that step ahead of the rest of the church around the world, as it were.
Precisely, yeah.
Father Mark, on that point about the Church of England getting ahead of other Christian churches around the world in terms of the General Synod and authority, what do you make of that? Does that ever concern you?
Well, I think that one of the main formularies of the Church of England is that we believe that we're part of the wider Church of God, but we also believe that the gospel has been proclaimed afresh in each generation, which means that through the synodical process, the Church of England has prayerfully discerned that it is right to ordain women. Now, I totally respect those Christians, both Anglican and others, who believe that that's not the case, or who believe that maybe we've gone about it the wrong way. But for many within the Church of England, in fact, the majority, they believe it's right to ordain women. And that process hasn't just taken place through a political process, but through a prayerful synodical process with much discussion, much debate over many, many years. And having personally been blessed by the ministry of women, I'm happy to be a part of that.
Mark, according to this study that we're talking about today from St. Mary's Twickenham, there are two waves, really, in terms of the exodus of Church of England priests and bishops since that initial stage of ordination of women. There was the ordination stage, then 2011 with the papal visit and the creation of the ordinariate that Father David's just mentioned. That was another wave of people crossing over into the Catholic Church. Do you think, Father Mark, that the installation of Cyril Mullally as Archbishop of Canterbury could produce another wave, a third wave?
Yes, I think it's likely there will be more people who will feel the need to either leave the Church of England or join one of the more conservative offshoots of the Anglican Communion. And people have to follow their conscience, so I totally respect that. Yeah. And one of the things I've found very important over the years is even when we don't necessarily agree with people who hold a different integrity or point of view, it's still important that we listen to them and learn from them, because there's a lot to be gained from learning the wisdom and the experience of those whose views differ from our own.
And Father David, if that were to be the case, if there is a third wave, that could be very useful for the Catholic Church's vocations.
Well, it could, because, I mean, the fascinating thing about this report that's come out recently was that just the sheer numbers, I would have guessed about 200 that had come across, but yeah, to find out 700 is way more than I expected.
And the other thing, I was surprised by 16 bishops as well. That's really significant. 16 bishops,
yeah. In fact, actually, the bishop who ordained me as an Anglican was Bishop Michael Nazarelli when he was Bishop of Rochester.
Yeah.
And then when I was a Catholic, he was received into the ordinariate when I was already part of it.
He was once on the list as a possible Archbishop of Canterbury, I
remember. Yes, indeed, yeah. But of course, the report also points out that about 30% of all Catholic ordinations in the last 30 years are ex-Anglicans, which is phenomenal, really.
Mark, you want to jump in there?
Yes, I just wanted to point out that the traffic goes in both directions. I mean, I had a curate in my last parish who had been a Roman Catholic priest and was received into the Church of England. The predecessor in my current parish grew up as a Roman Catholic, became an Anglican priest, and is now the Bishop of Burnley in the Diocese of Blackburn. So the traffic goes both ways. There are people who, in conscience, feel that they led to move from the Roman Catholic Church into the Church of England.
And in your experience, what was the motivation typically in that other way traffic?
Well, there are a number of issues.
I'm guessing.
Well, family life is part of it, certainly, but not necessarily the whole issue. There is also a sense of the Church of England being more open to the ordination of women and being more inclusive and being more open to you know, the movement of the spirit in, you know, in a different way. And I'm not saying one way is right and another way is wrong. I just
think
open. Yeah.
And just finally, Father David, I know some people use this word converted to the Catholic Church. It's a problem term, isn't it, for many people?
It's not a problem term for me, actually. And I have to say, it felt like a conversion. Now, I know some people say, well, no, actually, it's not a conversion in the sense, you know, I believed in Jesus, obviously, before I became a Catholic. So it's not in that sense.
Yeah, you're still a Christian one way or the other.
Still a Christian one way or the other. But there was a very much a huge sense of a change of understanding how the church works and how I submit to it and its, you know, its authority. So it does feel like a conversion, but it's, that's not to say we're saying other people aren't Christians. Of course, that makes perfect sense.
Thank you both very much, Father David Palmer and the Reverend Mark Wolverson. We were reminiscing last week, you may remember, about school hymns following the poll to choose the nation's favourite school hymn. Shine, Jesus, Shine, composed by Graham Kendrick, topped the poll in the end, and it prompted many of you to get in touch with us to tell us about your favourite hymn.
All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small.
So my name's Charmaine Obwan, and I'm 62. So my favourite hymn, and it's been a favourite since I was a child, is All Things Bright and Beautiful.
Each little bird that sings, he made their glowing colours.
I remember as a small child thinking how inspiring it was. And as a black person, as a child, I was really aware that not everybody was treated equally in the world. And somehow that hymn resonated that whatever else was happening in the world, whatever the political situation in the world, actually we are all created equally.
Hello, my name is Dania. I live in Purton in Wiltshire. My favourite hymn is When a Knight Won His Spurs. I remember singing it in the 1970s at primary school. It's always a kind of rousing tune, and I used to really enjoy the words as well because I could picture the knight with his charger. Always left me feeling really great.
I'm Susan Fry. I live in Bristol. My favourite hymn is God is Love, He's the Care. I didn't realise that was the name, actually. I used to think it was called Sing Aloud, Loud, Loud, because at school, that's what we did. So I went to secondary school in the 1960s, and we always had assembly. The best bit was the hymn singing, and this one was so rousing.
Thank you very much for getting in touch with us with all those suggestions. Let's hear, though, what it's like to compose a hymn that becomes popular, really popular, in the pews. Keith Getty, from Northern Ireland originally, wrote the Grammy-nominated hymn In Christ Alone, and he spoke to me this weekend from his home in Nashville.
There's nothing else in the world I would want to do. You know, I think it was the Scottish politician Fletcher in the 19th century said, I wish not to write the laws of my country if I could write its melodies. Mm. And I think that actually goes back to Plato and his contemporaries, way back with the Republic, the idea that what we sing ultimately determines the people and the culture more than anything else. And so the idea that I can be able to put something of sung grammar into believers' lives around the church. So whether you're a nervous mum somewhere in the UK, or whether you're a businessman in America, or whether you're somebody who's a martyr somewhere else in the world, this grammar and this melody has become part of your heart song is pretty awesome.
Well, you know? Given that deep bit of philosophy you've just offered us there, Keith, I'm a bit embarrassed to ask this question, but can you spot a banger when you write one?
You know, William, that's the funny thing. It's hard. You know, I've done 80 days this year. I have basically spent between 2 and 10 hours working on a new song the whole day and recording it at the end of the day, and I haven't published a single song this year. So that's 80 days that I've finished the day with a completed song that between myself and my co-writers, we think this is pretty good, but none of them are actually good enough. So, you know, for me, it's a life's work. You know, my heroes are creatively. You know, most of the songwriters broke early in their career, but most of my creative heroes, poets, authors, even some of the great preachers as well, you know, really, really got better as they went along. So that's my goal, is just to keep working at it. But it's hard.
I'm looking at this wall behind you as we're talking. Who is that? Bach?
Bach on one wall, and then of Charles Wesley on the other. And it's kind of a, but Bach's obviously my absolute hero for many reasons. But you know, Bach and Charles, it's kind of a nice reminder that even in my smartest, most clarion moment of the year, you know, I'm not going to be able to do what those guys did.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility when you write hymns?
Oh yeah,
The excitement of writing a successful hymn, obviously, and enjoying that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bach obviously had musical genius probably beyond anyone, but he also had a strong sense of theological responsibility. And then beyond that, he was actually just a local church dude. You know, he had the job in the Lutheran court, but he chose to leave that after a year just because the importance of writing music, what he called ordered music for God's church, was so much more important than serving kings and princes.
Is it fair to say, Keith, that the, and you've written lots, a tremendous amount, you've given us a lot, but In Christ Alone, is it still the hymn that people most connect with you when they introduce you?
I think that's God's way of keeping me humble in this whole thing, because that was the first song we wrote. So when we wrote that one, I mean, we hadn't a clue what we were doing. All I knew was I was really angry about what was being sung in church.
And when you say we, you mean Stuart Townend wrote the lyrics?
Yeah. He wrote, yeah, mostly. It's certainly all the best lyrics, I think, were his.
Right. So he's a sort of Bernie Taupin to your Elton John.
I guess there'll be, I think that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. And like them, we go music first. You know, so the dominant personality tends to go first, and then the more reactive and often the more intelligent person goes second in these things. But that was the first hymn of ours recorded, essentially. You know, that was the first hymn of ours put in a proper major released album. And of course, it's become, you know, one of the biggest hymns in copyright history.
In Christ alone, my hope is found. He is my light, my strength, my song. This cornerstone, this solid ground, firm through the fiercest drought and storm. What heights of love, what depths of peace, when fears are still and striving cease. My comforter, my all and all, here in the love of Christ I stand.
That song, I was just so angry with what was happening in church music generally, and feeling we need to do better, we need to be deeper, we need to have a stronger artistic footprint, and we need to be reaching the whole church. And we codenamed it the National Anthem of Christianity. That was the first hymn. We're going to call it, we codenamed it the National Anthem of Christianity. The melody was written on the back of a Northern Ireland electricity bill that I hadn't opened or paid. and so that was that.
You have a domestic collaboration and an artistic collaboration with your wife, Kristen. She's a wonderful artist in her own respect. Her voice is the voice of much of your work. And I understand that O Holy Night is on its way out, or maybe it's already been released in her voice.
No, it was released. It was released this past week.
Yeah,
we tried to do it several times. I know, William, this is your favorite carol from all our stories of your trips to New York every Christmas. And we'd always thought about doing it, and could never do it in a really unique way. And then, Chris, we listened to all the versions, and honestly, most of the versions are really about the artist and how spectacular they can be at the end. And we wanted a version which almost had something of the cathartic nature of what and the sense of peace that it brings. So we just said, let's try it with two of our girls. So two of our girls came in and did all their harmonies on it. So this version is particularly special to me because it's Kristen and then Eliza and Charlotte, two of our daughters.
Oh, here.
That's O Holy Night from Keith Getty and the Getty family there. It's a bit early for Christmas, but it is Advent Sunday, so we'll use that to justify it. And Keith Getty's Home for Christmas tour begins on the 17th of December in Glasgow. A three-part painting featuring five of Christ's miracles has been valued at £3.5 million. It became known as the Master of the Sherborne Almshouse Triptych, and it has been kept at a Dorset almshouse for the last six centuries. The painting was analysed by experts who concluded that it is the only surviving work of an unknown painter who was active in Brussels in the late 15th century. It will be auctioned this coming week, and money from the sale will help to improve the quality of accommodation offered by the St John's Almshouse charity. Steve Harris has this report.
St John's Almshouse, here in the shadow of Sherborne Abbey, has been extraordinarily lucky. They've been providing homes for the poor and feeble for almost six centuries, but they've just found out their most treasured painting could be worth as much as £3.5 million.
So here we've got a nice ancient door on the outside, and then with our modern practicalities, well, it's still quite an ancient door, but it's a fire door on the inside, and brings us into the chapel, which is original part of the almshouse.
So my name's Mike Burks, and I'm currently the submaster of the almshouse of St. John in Sherborne.
So on the left-hand side panel, we have the Christ casting out the devil. You can see the devil coming out of this poor fellow's mouth there. And then on the main central panel, that's the rising of Lazarus.
It's not the triptych that currently sits on the altar here in Sherborne. That's safely with the auctioneers. But this replica is representative. It's large, more than 2 metres from end to end, about 1 metre high. It depicts five of the miracles of Christ. Apparently it came to the almshouse before the Reformation and only survived Puritan iconoclasts because it could be folded up and hidden in the boardroom here.
It must be remarkable to think that this thing lived here for hundreds of years. And, you know, you knew it was worth something, but for it to be valued at £3.5 million.
People have always appreciated it. I've always appreciated it as a beautiful piece of art, and quite special that it's been here for so long in the same place, and that just sort of gives it, you know, a great history and a great feel. And someone said to us the other day that it was being put here for a reason. They felt as a Christian that the reason what we were now finding out was it to be able to provide the charity with the funds to be able to take it forward for another 600 years.
So there's an old sign there.
Yeah.
For the famous medieval chapel and triptych.
Yeah.
Royal Charter, Ancient Pewter and Other Treasures. Admission 40p. Now, realising this beautiful painting is actually a Flemish rarity is not that straightforward. Eight world-renowned experts analysed this using methods including infrared reflectography and something called dendrochronology, as Alex Bell from Sotheby's Old Masters Paintings Department explains.
It would have been a valuable item when it was made. Obviously the function was rather different. It was something that was intended to sort of demonstrate, in this case, the power of Christ in terms of healing and raising from the dead. Being able to demonstrate that it is a picture that dates from the late 15th century was important, and there are a number of ways you can do that, one of which is called dendrochronology, where it's basically the science of counting tree rings, because this painting is made up of a series of panels. They all are made out of oak. The oak comes from trees which were growing in the eastern Baltic region of Europe, and you can date the panel from counting the tree rings and working out when the trees were actually growing. So we think this is painted in Brussels about 1480, 1490 by an artist that we don't know, and in this case because we don't know him, but it's because it's an important item, we've named it the Master of the Sherborne Almshouse Triptych.
That full list of residents.
What of resident that is. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
There you are.
Yeah.
Mr. Andy Burks.
Yes.
Mike Burks is quite sanguine about letting this painting go. It has been here for hundreds of years, but the Brethren looked at selling it in 1964. Its valuation then of £2,500 they considered to be too little. If it gets anywhere near realising the £3.5 million top estimate this time around, the board will be counting their blessings.
I'll be in two minds, really. One will be enjoying the fact that we will now have funds to do the right thing for the charity. That's the overriding thing. But there will also be a sadness, I think, in all of us, because the decision to sell has not been an easy one. But I'm convinced, we are convinced, that it's the right thing to do, because we have to remember that we are not a museum for art. We are a place for vulnerable people to live. If someone else can look after that piece of art in a better way than we can, and hopefully in a situation where lots of other people can see it, then I think that's a win-win solution.
Mike Burks there, ending that report from Steve Harris. 26 minutes to 8, still to come this morning. We will bring you the latest from Pope Leo, who's in the Middle East as part of his first overseas visit or apostolic journey. Being a Muslim football fan in the UK is not always easy. Islamophobic incidents at football grounds have reached record highs in recent years, according to the anti-racism charity Kick It Out. And while many Muslims still struggle to find suitable prayer spaces, halal food options, or even alcohol-free areas, some progress is being made. More Premier League clubs are now introducing dedicated prayer rooms, with some even hosting iftar celebrations on the pitch. In September, Jed Spence became the first Muslim to play for England's senior men's team.
Obviously, I was surprised. I didn't know I was the first, but I guess it's a blessing, and you know, I guess it can pave the way for many kids out there.
There was another milestone this weekend when the Chelsea Muslim supporters took on Man United Muslim supporters in the first ever match of its kind. What was the result? 7-3 to Chelsea. Joining me now, the founders of both supporters groups. Soheb Gaj supports Chelsea. Asif Mahmood is a Man United fan. Welcome both of you. Asif, 7-3.
Yeah, not the best result, but
it sounds like a rugby score.
we took part. We tried our best, and hopefully United will do better today.
Tell me about this. First of all, this encounter between Chelsea and Manchester United fans, is this the beginning of a new kind of league for supporters?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think the match was much more than just the score itself. It was bringing together a community. Making it competitive, full of energy, but also the first of its kind in bringing official support group clubs together to host such an event was special. And credit to Man United Muslims Group as well. They came to play. They didn't make it easy. It was something that everyone won't forget. And to be at Cobham as well was a good experience.
Got to ask you both, Asif first, please, just to explain for us why you think it's necessary, because it could look like a kind of parallel experience for supporters who happen to be Muslim.
I think it's just a good opportunity for our members to get more connected to their respective clubs and engage with other supporters clubs. I know yesterday was two Muslim supporters clubs playing against each other, but in the wider picture, as far as I know, there hasn't been any kind of official game like this between supporters clubs backed by their respective football clubs. So it mm-hmm. could open opportunities for interfaith games and other supporters clubs of faith and no faith to collaborate and engage with each other.
So is it also necessary because Muslim supporters feel a little bit uncomfortable at times in the more general supporters environment?
Yeah, I think that definitely paves a way into it. I think historically, given the issues that we've had with racism in football, I think that the introduction of supporter groups like ours helps pave the way for supporters to feel that inclusion. I think the game was also necessary because the football has the power to bring people together in a way that very few things can. And for us, the two Muslim supporter group, using the sport we love to create unity, raise money, and show the positive side of our communities is a massive factor.
But I wonder, Asif, if it's also possibly an indictment of football in the UK today, if Muslim supporters feel like they need to create their own kind of safe haven in that world.
Yeah, I can understand that point. I think, you know, we do get feedback from our members on why they've joined and why they feel that, you know, there is a need for organizations such as ourselves to have a safe space where they feel like, you know, they feel more connected. But at the same time, you know, it gives us an opportunity to engage not just with the football club, but with other supporters clubs that Man United have, and try and, you know, bring more inclusion all around. So I think, I agree. But at the same time, I think it gives us the opportunity to work on those aspects.
So how have things in your experience changed comparing today with when you first started following football as a Muslim?
I think what groups like ours do is fill that gap. So we're not just hiding from football, but we're bringing more people into it. We're showing the sport how to evolve. And I think Chelsea are a perfect example of that evolution, as well as Man United. Speaking on Chelsea's behalf, like, they didn't just tolerate us, they embraced us in terms of our vision and what we're aiming to do, to create one of the first Muslim supporters group and host, you know, the open iftars that they've had and the Eid events every year and open the doors for us at every level is valuable.
I think Chelsea was one of the first to do the open iftar at the pitch, weren't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they were one of the first globally to do that.
And what about the players, Asif? And I'll ask you as well, Sahib. I mentioned Jed Spence earlier. We could also mention Liverpool's Mo Salah. When you see successful Muslim players, how significant is that for you personally and as a person of faith and for your community?
Yeah, I think it's massive. You know, I'm sure most football fans, when they're young, they dream about playing for the club that they support and they dream about it. And when you grow up and actually see other Muslim footballers being embraced by their clubs, and you know, you mentioned about change, and I think over the last since I was a kid, you can see that footballers from different backgrounds, and you know, in particular Muslim footballers, are not afraid to kind of hide their Muslimness, if that's even a word. But you know, they, you know, Mo Salah, the way he celebrates, or you know, last year we saw Nasir Mazraoui and others breaking their fast on the side of the pitch, and it was something that they felt comfortable doing in the open. And I think that's where we've seen positive change. And for Muslim fans, it shows that, you know, yes, we are accepted and things have changed.
Please comment on that, Soha, but also give the clubs out there some advice on how they might help things become more positive for Muslims in the future.
Yeah, I think just to top off what Asif said, where he put it quite nicely, but I think, you know, it really gives a sense of belonging, not just to the Muslim players, the employees at the club, but also the supporters itself. And I think that tells the Muslim fans and Muslim players that you don't just have to hide from who you are, but actually, you know, can be part of this club, and they can bring their identity to the club because they feel that sense of belonging.
Thank you both very much. Soab Gaj from the Chelsea Supporters Group and Asif Mahmood from the Manchester United Supporters Group. This, incidentally, is a very special day over on BBC Radio 3. Carols Across the Country is casting its net wide, capturing live performances and spirited conversations from every corner of the UK, from the shadowy slopes of the Mourne Mountains to the windswept shoreline of St Andrews and the rolling hills of the Staffordshire Peak District. And in just over an hour, Sarah Walker will take us inside Quar Abbey on the Isle of Wight for a live broadcast. And she joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
I must say, Quar Abbey, I've just been looking at their website. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It really is. It's an extraordinary building, actually, and completely unique. The location as it stands now, it's an early 20th century construction. And it's designed in a style that's very Moorish looking. You almost feel like you could be in Spain.
Like,
so this
turrets.
Is nothing like... There are turrets. It's nothing like the bleached bones of the ruined Yorkshire abbeys, if you picture that as, you know, the old Cistercian abbeys. It's nothing like that. And it's built from Belgian brick, which is sort of terracotta and pink and beige. changing colour. Every brick is a different colour. And in layout, though, it is like a medieval abbey. So it's all centred around this big church. And that's just where I'm standing right now, just outside the church with its big turrets. And there's, you know, a cloister, there's a chapter house, a refectory. And it is a living community of monks as well. There are there's a community of Benedictine monks here. And they're actually going to be singing for us. There's going to be a plain chant for the first Sunday of Advent. So really looking forward to hearing them.
For those who don't know what plain chant is, Sarah, give us a dictionary definition.
Okay, so if you're a music student,
weren't expecting that
plain
question.
Chant,
yeah, we pitch low.
No, really, for anybody, it's very interesting because plain chant is really where classical music began.
Right.
So in the monasteries of, you know, the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, and the monks, well, firstly, they were just singing these melodies that became linked to certain parts of the church calendar. So these old austere melodies, firstly just a single line, and then some crazy monk added a second line, so there's a bit of harmony, and then someone added a bit of rhythm, and then someone started writing it down. And so that's really how important plain chant is. And once it was written down, of course, then it could all then it could transfer all around Europe, all around the world, and classical music thus began.
How many voices will you have in Quor Abbey giving us some plain chant today?
Oh, there won't be very many. The monks have a schola of the ones who love to sing. So I think there'll be about eight of them singing together. So not a huge choir. But we are going to hear them in the church, which is very ambient and very atmospheric. So I have a feeling that the voices will feel like they're being kind of magnified.
So wonderful acoustics, gorgeous building, and we'll hear some plain chant. That sounds wonderful. This all fits into what Radio 3 is doing today with carols, and it's a massive undertaking, actually.
Yeah, you know, I think carols across the country is rapidly becoming a tradition here at Radio 3. We started last year with the idea of spending the first day of Advent visiting a few different venues spread across the UK just to immerse ourselves in the old Advent musical traditions and local musical traditions, because, you know, it's different everywhere you go. And live music is a really important part of what we do. And we have live musicians coming in today, as well as the monks. We have a wonderful period instrument trio called the Fantasia Trio. They'll be playing for us. There'll be recordings as well. And it's not just sacred music too. We try to just bring in seasonal music, so wintry music, snowy music, twinkling lights, home and hearth, all the sort of cozy images. So we just try to make it the perfect combination of music for a day like this.
So from plain chant to jazz and beyond, we could say that.
Yeah. Absolutely, everything will be there.
You get some folk music in there too?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is that the trio that we're hearing from, the Fantasia Trio, they've actually dug up some traditional music from the Isle of Wight. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that. You know, I've no idea what that's going to be like. Something they've discovered themselves. So I'll be asking them about it as well.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I'll be listening out for that Benedictine version of Gregorian chant in plain song coming up from Quor Abbey. That's Sarah Walker, and you can listen on BBC Radio 3 throughout the day for that wonderful undertaking. Very creative. Carols across the country. Pope Leo travels to Lebanon later today. It's the next stage in his first overseas tour. The apostolic journey began last Thursday in Turkey, where the Pope joined the spiritual leader of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople, to jointly commemorate the 1700th anniversary of the First Council of Nicaea, which, of course, gave the Church the Nicene Creed. While in Istanbul, the Pope called for unity.
We must strongly reject the use of religion for justifying war, violence, or any form of fundamentalism or fanaticism. Instead, the paths to follow are those of fraternal encounter, dialogue, and cooperation.
Our BBC Religion editor, Aleem Makbul, is travelling with the Pope and joins us now. Good morning, Aleem.
Yes, morning, William.
When is the Pope actually setting out for the second part of this tour to Lebanon?
Later today, I've just stepped outside at St. George's Cathedral in Istanbul, which is where Patriarch Bartholomew, who leads Eastern Orthodox Christians, and Pope Leo are jointly leading a service there, and that really has been the theme of this leg of the visit, the first foreign trip that the Pope is making in the 6 months of his papacy. It's been about brotherhood, it's been about unity, it's been about bringing different denominations within Christianity together, but also about reaching out to other faiths as well. And so, yes, this part of the trip was always really, I suppose, in the diary, whoever the Pope was, because of that 1700th anniversary of the First Council of Nicaea that took place in 325 in what's modern-day Turkey. But they had an extraordinary service at that site over the archaeological ruins there of the basilica in what was Nicaea, which was very much talking about unity, about coming together, remembering what that council was about, which was these different traditions uniting under various ideas, including the affirmation of the belief that Jesus was the Son of God, but also a united date to celebrate Easter. Since then, of course, these various traditions split dramatically in some cases, but this was about affirming how they could come together in the future. And indeed, the Patriarch and Pope signed a joint declaration to that end yesterday.
I noticed a number of the media outlets picking up on the fact that when the Pope visited Istanbul's famous Blue Mosque, he took his shoes off, as is commonly done, but he did not pray within that within the mosque. I think his two predecessors actually took their shoes off but did pray while they were there. What do you read into that? What significance is there to that?
Well, the Vatican has been a little bit frustrated by some of the coverage, saying it wasn't really a big deal because he did stop to contemplate. And actually, we had asked the question before as to whether he was going to pray in the mosque or not. And they said it would be up to him, but he would certainly reflect at some point. Yes, he took his shoes off. That was expected. And he is now I think it's five out of the last six popes that have visited Istanbul. Most have visited mosques. But you're right to say that Pope Benedict and Pope Francis both prayed when they entered a mosque. But it's the more I ask, the more they tell us that it really is not a
or
big
the
deal
less they tell you, probably, because being the Vatican, yes.
But what
well,
they
you
are
can understand
is
why some people would be concerned that they think this is the first American pope. Is the pope concerned about how a gesture like that might be seen in the United States amongst, for example, MAGA supporting Catholics there?
Well, look, he's certainly been very measured over the last 6 months. He's certainly been very careful to pull back in, I suppose, though, the more traditional Catholics who might have been upset by some of the moves that his predecessor made, for example. He's certainly keen to move everyone forward together or bring everyone together in the first place. And look, he did visit a mosque. It was about reaching out, and it very much fit the theme of this trip, where at one point he talked about, you know, he stood alongside President Erdogan. Mm-hmm. We can see him growing as a sort of head of state, by the way, during this trip as well. But he stood next to President Erdogan and talked about children of Abraham, Jews, Christians, Muslims, in fraternity and building bridges with people outside their own faiths and coming together in a common cause of peace and brotherhood. So visiting a mosque in itself sort of fit that theme, and a lot of what he said has certainly been reaching out to others. And yes, maybe some traditionalists might have been upset by some of those messages, so that's why I think the Vatican are a little upset about the focus of it, because there have been so many other things during this leg of the trip that have been about reaching out.
Well, indeed, and the content of his message is very significant when he's challenging, for example, the weaponization of religion, the use and abuse of religion for extremism, for fanaticism. We're hearing those very strong messages.
Absolutely. I mean, some might raise their eyebrow at that, because of course that's nothing new, and we're looking back over the last sort of 17 years during this part of the trip, and of course the weaponization of religion, religion being the basis of war, is not something that's new, but certainly it's the ambition that he's trying to get across. And, you know, you'll remember when he stood on the balcony at St. Peter's 6 months ago, he immediately was talking about building bridges, about bringing an end to conflicts.
Yeah.
And it has very much been the theme of his papacy. So often at his weekly address, he's prayed at the Angelus, for example, about peace, about the end of conflict. And, you know, we're seeing play out on this trip a lot of the themes that we keep hearing from him about building bridges, whether it's within the faith or outside it.
Alim, thank you very much. Alim McBull, our BBC Religion editor. That's it from this week's edition of Sunday. Say hello to us on Sunday on social media. BBC R4 Sunday. See you next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Katie Booth and James Leasley. Now, Michael Palin makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Trees for Cities.
That's the sound of an orchard in late autumn. Bees search out the last of the season's flowers, birds pick at ripe fruit, and copper leaves rustle in the breeze. While this might sound like a countryside scene, it is in fact an orchard in the heart of Tower Hamlets, one of the most densely populated boroughs in London. Today, it's a sanctuary for thousands of people living in nearby high-rise flats to grow food and connect with nature and each other, whatever the season. But it hasn't always been this way. Not so long ago, the area was described as a wasteland, with little to screen noise and pollution from the busy A Road nearby. But then a group of determined volunteers from the charity Trees for Cities planted 50 handsome fruit trees and changed everything.
Planting it in a new pot.
10-year-old Ariana lives on the estate with her family. Like so many children in towns and cities, she doesn't have a garden of her own. But the orchard has given her a space to play outside, plant flowers and discover wildlife.
I feel relaxed because I'm surrounded by nature.
Good for my health, and I come down here to sort of like exercising and, you know, the fresh air.
For long-term resident Lindsay, the orchard has helped to boost his well-being after a lung cancer diagnosis. Tending to his veg patch and joining in events with his neighbours in the orchard have helped to curb loneliness.
Well, we are friendly. We talk to each other before, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't even say hello to each other. We just walk by.
That's the difference Trees for Cities makes to people up and down the UK. They plant trees where they're needed most. I've even helped to plant a few of them myself. But the reality is, millions living in towns and cities still don't have access to trees and nature close by. A gift of £40 could plant 5 saplings. £60 could buy mulch to help the trees grow. And £175 could help care for a tree in its first year. Plus, the first £40,000 of donations will be doubled by 2 supporters. You can give now by searching online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or by calling 0800 404 8144 or write a cheque to Free Post BBC Radio 4 Appeal. And please mark the back of your envelope Trees for Cities. Thank you.
Michael Palin, that number again, 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles, and all the details for giving online are there if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. And if you'd like to know more about how your donation helps the charities, just search online for What Your Money Does, Radio 4 Appeal. Now, I had to scrape the windscreen this morning for the weather prospects. Now, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, John. Yes, a chilly start to the day with temperatures typically a few degrees either side of freezing out there. And we've got a few icy stretches around, especially across parts of northern England and eastern Scotland, where we've had some wintry showers falling on chilly surfaces. But through today, actually many of us having a pretty decent looking Sunday. Lots of dry weather on the cards. A few showers here and there, but there'll be some sunshine on offer and lighter winds than recent days too. But it is going to be a window of dry weather before some heavy persistent rain moves in from the west overnight. But let's look at today's detail, and we'll start with southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England. Yes, a cold to start, some frost in places, but plenty of sunshine on offer, fairly light winds, and temperatures here typically around 7 to 9 degrees, so a little cooler than yesterday, but certainly drier. For northern England, eastern Scotland and northern Scotland, we've got a few showers still lingering around, but they should ease away over the next few hours, some of them a little bit wintry over the highest ground, but sunshine soon reappearing if you haven't already got it here. It won't feel particularly warm today, just 2 or 3 in the northeast of Scotland, around 6 or 7 for northern England. Meanwhile, towards the west, so we're looking at southwest England, Wales into southwest Scotland and Northern Ireland today. A few showers around here, particularly affecting parts of Wales, the Isle of Man seeing a few as well, but they should ease away. Lot of dry weather, sunny spells around, but the cloud will increase into the afternoon ahead of the rain arriving this evening, and temperatures around 7 to 11. So tonight, it turns particularly windy and wet from the west, and then that rain sweeps eastwards across all areas as we head towards dawn. There is an amber warning in force for heavy rain across the south of Wales. There could be more than 100 millimetres of rain over the highest ground, enough to cause some flooding, and that amber warning comes in force from midnight. But plenty of wet weather for England and Wales tomorrow. It does turn brighter for Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Paddy O'Connell is here with news of Broadcasting House at 9. Paddy, what have you got?
John, sorry you had to scrape your windscreen. Looking at me, you look like you're scraping the barrel sometimes. Good morning. And good morning to you. Well, the Chancellor's touring the TV studios around now with calls to go over what she knew and what she said about public finances. We'll tune in. Sir Tom Stoppard is dead. We pay tribute to the man who earned an Oscar, a handful of Tonys, and an entry in the Oxford English Dictionary, Stoppardian. Christmas music begins earlier and earlier, it seems, but on Advent Sunday, we hear an appeal for less Mariah and more Messiah from Petroc Trelawney, Radio 3 Elf. We meet a man on board an Airbus, which dropped with that solar glitch in the software, and hear from Feedback, which wants nominations for Interview of the Year. Our headliners are Peter Hitchens, Joe Coburn and Darren McGarvey.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of November. Good morning. This is Tina Ritchie. The government has confirmed it will set out significant changes to the criminal justice system this week, including a reduction in the number of trials by jury. Keir Starmer will use a speech to back the Chancellor's budget as the Treasury continues to face questions over whether it was transparent about the state of the public finances. High-level talks are set to take place in Florida between officials from Ukraine and the US about ending the war with Russia. The government has confirmed it will announce in the coming week major changes to the criminal justice system in England and Wales, including a reduction in the number of trials heard by a jury. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, says once-in-a-generation reforms are needed to clear a backlog in courts where some cases are not due to be heard until 2030. Here's our correspondent, Tom Symonds.
The courts are dealing with a backlog that began during the COVID-19 pandemic. 80,000 cases are waiting to go in front of judges. Victims of crime, especially sexual crime, are much more likely to withdraw from the justice process if they're forced to wait. The government's plan is expected to focus on dispensing with juries in more cases, beyond those currently heard by magistrates, which can result in prison sentences of up to 2 years. Under the proposals, magistrates may be allowed to pass sentences of up to 5 years. The government says magistrates' courts already decide 90% of cases and only 3% go in front of a Crown Court jury. Sources say the changes will be bold and played down reports that the plan set out in an internal Ministry of Justice briefing seen by the BBC last week will be watered down. Both the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats strongly oppose a move away from jury trials.
Sir Keir Starmer will give his backing to the Chancellor's budget in a speech tomorrow after Downing Street dismissed claims that Rachel Reeves misled voters over the state of the economy as categorically untrue. The Conservatives have accused Ms Reeves of giving an overly pessimistic impression of the public finances as a smokescreen to raise taxes. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley has more details.
The Prime Minister will argue that the budget has set the economy on a better course, helping people with the cost of living and ensuring economic stability. Despite the Office for Budget Responsibility downgrading growth from next year, Sir Keir Starmer will argue growth has beaten forecasts and that investment in protecting public services will drive it in the future. The speech, just 5 days after the budget, suggests some nervousness that the government's economic plans may not have landed in the way ministers had hoped. Number 10 says it was always part of the plan to sell the budget. The Prime Minister will also address the report this week, which found the UK was the most expensive place in the world to build nuclear power. Sir Keir will highlight unnecessary red tape in the sector, saying an urgent correction is needed.
Officials from Ukraine will meet the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff in Florida later to continue talks on the White House plan to end the conflict with Russia. The Ukrainian delegation will be headed by the country's National Security Council chief, Rustem Umerov. He's replaced Andrei Yermak, who resigned as Kyiv's lead negotiator and President Zelensky's chief of staff after an anti-corruption raid on his home. The former US ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, says today's talks will shape Mr. Witkoff's approach to meetings in Moscow later this week.
He's going to see Vladimir Putin. He's the one who cooked up the very bad 28-point plan. Rubio corrected that into this plan that was done with Europeans and Ukrainians. But now it's Witkoff going back to Moscow again. So I think the whole point of the Ukrainian trip is to set some guardrails so that we know what Witkoff is actually going to say to the Russians.
Kazakhstan has expressed anger at Ukraine after a drone attack halted operations at a Russian oil terminal it uses. The Russian port of Novorossiysk on the Black Sea was hit on Friday night. The Kazakh Foreign Ministry said the facility was protected by international law and the attack had harmed relations with Ukraine. At least four people have been killed in a shooting at a child's birthday party in California. 10 others were injured in the attack in the city of Stockton. The suspect remains at large. Simon Jones reports.
The local sheriff's office has described the shooting as unfathomable. It happened just before 6 o'clock in the evening at a family gathering which was taking place at a restaurant. Officers believe the attack may have been targeted, though they say they are exploring all possibilities. Children were among the victims. The suspect, who fled the scene, remains at large. Stockton's vice mayor, Jason Lee, wrote on social media that he was devastated and angry, adding, "A birthday party should never be a place where families fear for their lives."
The inaugural party conference for what's currently known as Your Party will resume later, after yesterday showed apparent divisions between the movement's co-founders Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. Ms. Sultana boycotted the first day of the event, saying the fledgling left-wing party had a toxic culture. Mr. Corbyn is expected to unveil the name of the party this evening. There'll also be a decision on whether it should have a single leader, which is likely to provoke a contest between Mr. Corbyn and Ms. Sultana, or if it should be run by a committee. People in Honduras will vote today in a general election that's drawn international attention after an intervention by President Trump. The left-wing presidential candidate, Rixi Moncada, has accused the US of meddling in the campaign after Mr. Trump threatened to cut funding for Honduras if people did not vote for the right-wing contender, Nasri Asfura. The supermodel David Gandy has warned that a generation of young boys face being driven to extreme masculinity because of social media. He was speaking after a new report by the Centre for Social Justice think tank asked why so many boys and young men were failing at school and dropping out of the workforce. Gandy, who became one of the world's highest paid male models for his work with the fashion house Dolce & Gabbana, told the BBC's Laura Kunzberg that many young boys today misunderstood what masculinity was.
People look at me and they say, well, you, when we look at you, you seem to define masculinity. And then I say, how? And they say, well, in fact, you're into your cars, your classic cars, your suits, your watches, you're a skier, you're this big figure. I said, yes, but I do the washing, I do the cleaning, I do the school run. That wouldn't be deemed as masculinity. You see, our roles have changed. We are the first generation, I believe, my age, where we're seeing the dads who have to take on a different role. My wife's a barrister. I certainly wouldn't mess with her.
You can watch the full interview on Sunday with Laura Kunzberg from 9 o'clock on BBC One. Britain's Lando Norris will clinch his first Formula One World Championship today if he wins the Qatar Grand Prix. The McLaren driver will start the penultimate race of the season with a 22-point lead over his teammate Oscar Piastri. The fallout from Wednesday's budget continues to dominate the newspapers. The Sunday Times tells its readers the Prime Minister will intervene to shore up his Chancellor, who it describes as engulfed in a damaging row about whether she was honest with voters about the state of the economy. The Mail on Sunday says Rachel Reeves must resign for lying, referring to accusations she knew the OBR forecast on the economy was better than originally thought when she unveiled her financial plans. The Sunday Telegraph asserts that Sir Keir Starmer signed off the Chancellor's speech, which it describes as black hole lies, and declares that Ms Reeves' career is on the brink and she could take Starmer down with her. In response, Downing Street said Ms Reeves' comments were entirely accurate and that the Prime Minister was aware of the speech and the OBR's figures. Details of a Centre for Social Justice report are highlighted by the Sunday Express. It says families with three children need to earn £71,000 to bring in as much money as a similar household living on benefits. The think tank is quoted as warning that Britain is in a welfare crisis because of what it calls Rachel Reeves' benefit budget. The government said it delivered a budget that cut debt, borrowing and the cost of living. The Sunday Times carries an interview with a worshipper who was accidentally shot by police as he barricaded the doors at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester to try to stop an attacker getting inside. Yoni Finlay is credited with saving countless lives last month. He tells the paper of the huge amount of guilt that he survived and how he's considering a moving to Israel to keep his children safe because there is so much hate in the UK. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, Ukraine's ambassador to the UK, General Valery Zoltani, says his country has a chance to embrace political change after a peace deal is signed. Tipped as a future president, he also says Ukraine needs to rid itself of corruption and bring in reforms to prosper when the war is over. The death of the acclaimed playwright Sir Tom Stoppard features in many of the papers, with The Observer devoting its entire front page to a picture of him as a young man, along with the phrase, "Words, words, they're all we have to go on." The paper says he'll be remembered for his wit, irreverence and generosity of spirit. And that's our look at this morning's papers.
Read this morning by Tina Ritchie. Now it's time for the first in a series of Sunday Worship, celebrating writers whose work can enrich the journey through Advent. We go live now to the chapel of the University of St Andrews.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us in St Andrews, a small town on the east coast of Scotland with a long history. I'm Donald McEwen, the university chaplain. A university has clung to this windswept corner of Fife for over 600 years. Students and scholars reading, thinking, researching, teaching and writing. And we have gathered this morning in St. Salvator's Chapel in the university where worship has been offered since the 15th century. The town is named for St. Andrew, Scotland's patron saint, a fisherman disciple of Jesus. And today is St. Andrew's Day. But it is also the first Sunday of Advent, the season looking forward to the birth of Jesus, whose disciple Andrew was. What better way of beginning Advent than in the ancient song of expectation, O come, Emmanuel.
Thank you.
St Andrews may be a small town, but it has a global population of students and lecturers. I've been struck over recent days how many new international students here have asked me how people cope with the short, dark winter days. You get used to it, I say. Advent makes much in the Northern Hemisphere of the metaphor of light in darkness. Later, we'll be joined by a professor of Bible and Literature, the Reverend Alison Jack of Edinburgh University, who will explore the powerful work of Scottish writer Edwin Muir and how it can help us begin this Advent journey from darkness into light. St. Salvator's Chapel Choir will now sing of God's light scattering the darkness in this setting of A Tender Shoot by Carenza Briggs. We are led in prayer now by Samantha Ferguson, Assistant Chaplain.
God of creation, from your loving hand has come the beauty of nature, the turning seasons, the time of cold, winds from the north, short days and long nights. We thank you for the coming of light, your advent in our world, sharing our creaturely life. We give thanks for the Word made flesh and for all who have followed Christ in faithfulness and frailty. We remember Andrew's enthusiasm and courage, giving thanks for his faith shared by many in Scotland and beyond, especially those who wrestle with words to express this faith afresh in our own time. Merciful God, as we enter this season of Advent, we are conscious of the ways we choose darkness over light and fail in word and action to follow your Son. Forgive us and help us find fresh ways to listen and to love. Through Christ, our coming Lord. Amen.
Scots have long been drawn to the written word, and some of the most famous fictional characters have emerged from Scotland, from Jekyll and Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson to Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. The poems and songs of Robert Burns are celebrated and sung all round the world. Edwin Muir was one writer who made his home right here in St Andrews. Born in Dearness, Orkney, in 1887, Muir grew up both there and in Glasgow. He was to become one of Scotland's most significant 20th century poets. On marrying Willa Anderson in 1919, he and Willa moved from place to place across Europe and Britain, both writing and working together on translations of Franz Kafka and other authors. Edwin's first book of poetry came out in 1925, and 10 years later, he and Willa moved to St Andrews. Before Alison reflects on Muir's work, a hymn now from Scotland, written by John Bell and Graham Moll, exploring the Word of God in human voice.
As Donald has said, in the late 1930s, Edwin Muir and his wife Willa were living beside the North Sea in St Andrews. And to be honest, they were finding the setting less than conducive to creative endeavour. Millennia before this, the gospel writer Matthew has Jesus at the beginning of his ministry, withdrawing to the shore of the Sea of Galilee, to the village of Capernaum. Isaiah had imagined it would be here, in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, that a light would dawn in the darkness. It's here that Jesus finds his prophetic preaching voice. Matthew sets the scene in this reading from chapter 4, which is read by Professor Dame Sally Mapstone, Principal and Vice Chancellor of the University.
Now when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the lake, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time, Jesus began to proclaim, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near."
It's while Edwin Muir is in St. Andrews and his wife is unwell and in a nursing home, and the world is darkening on the eve of World War II, that he senses something of this nearness of the kingdom of God. In his autobiography, Muir describes coming home from visiting his wife one dark evening and seeing children playing marbles on the street. Perhaps this was a reminder to him of his own childhood, but he writes that it seemed a simple little rehearsal for a resurrection, promising a timeless renewal of life. Later that evening, he finds himself reciting the Lord's Prayer aloud with growing conviction and a sense that he was being replenished and astonished and delighted by the fullness of meaning he was discovering. In joyful surprise, he realizes anew the universal and inexhaustible riches of the prayer, which sanctified human life. He comes to the conclusion that quite without knowing it, he was a Christian, no matter how bad a one. Muir goes on in the following months to return many times to the New Testament and the story of Jesus. He's not drawn to any church, or indeed to what he calls the splendors of Christendom. These will be revealed to him when he travels to Italy many years later. But he has a deepening sense that Christ is, as he puts it, the turning point of time and the meaning of life to everyone. Muir is lit up by the realization that the grace of God goes before him. There's an all-readiness to his experience of God, the drawing near of the kingdom of heaven, which Jesus had preached about beside another sea so far away. The deep-rootedness of religious myths and symbols in modern consciousness is something Muir returns to again and again in his poetry. In one of his most famous poems, he stands, one foot in Eden still, while looking across what he calls the other land of current experience. Holding the two together, both the hope of a time of restoration and of an understanding of the blossoms of grief and charity of actual life, brings strange blessings, never to be found in the Eden of the memory or longing. Jesus' preaching reflects something of this now and not yet quality in its understanding of the kingdom of heaven. Seek the blessings of this liminality, of this threshold space, he seems to say. Hold fast to the glimmers of light in the darkness. Trust in the one who is both off this world and beyond it. But first, Jesus calls for action. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near, he proclaims to all who will listen. Repentance in religious contexts usually involves an admission of where one's gone wrong and a commitment to change one's ways. But the word also in the original Greek implies a revolution in thinking, a volte-face, a moment of insight which changes everything. We might call Muir's moment of clarity on a dark evening in St. Andrews on the brink of war such a moment. In the next episode in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus calls Simon Peter and Andrew to act on a similar moment of startling reversal. We'll hear that part of the story after Charles Villiers Stanford's setting of Psalm 150, a call to praise God by offering the best of our human creativity.
as Jesus walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." Immediately they left their nets and followed him.
Who could have imagined that such a moment of life-changing decision beside the Sea of Galilee would lead, in legend at least, to the bones of one of those fishermen being shipwrecked on the faraway shores of Scotland, or, because of that legend, the rising up of a pilgrim destination which would eventually bear his name, St. Andrews. And it was here that Edwin Muir came to his moment of realisation of the ongoing significance of the presence of Jesus in his life and the life of the world. The moment sharpens his understanding of the human longing for a rewinding of time and the possibility of creation reimagined through the work of Christ. Muir expresses this longing very movingly in a much later poem about the Transfiguration, an episode in the life of Jesus which gives his disciples a glimpse of the glory of the resurrection. In the second stanza of the poem, Muir reflects on the somewhat puzzling teaching of Jesus about his return, his second coming, which is one of the key themes of this season of Advent. "But he will come again," it said, "though not unwanted, unsummoned, for all things, beasts of the field and woods and rocks and seas, and all mankind from end to end of the earth will call him with one voice. In our own time, some say, or at a time when time is ripe, then he will come, Christ the uncrucified, Christ the discrucified, his death undone, his agony unmade, his cross dismantled, glad to be so, and the tormented wood will cure its hurt and grow into a tree in a green springing corner of young Eden. And Judas, damned, take his long journey backward from darkness into light and be a child beside his mother's knee, and the betrayal be quite undone and never more be done." With a poet's delicate touch, Muir offers us a way to imagine a world in which all the actions we regret and the hurts we have caused and the damage we have done to God's good creation might be reversed, not forgotten or their effect unrecognized, but somehow taken up into the loving understanding of God. Muir doesn't speak the language of systematic theology or modern psychology or the science of climate change, but from a place of deep conviction and epiphany, he offers us, in the language of poetry and metaphor, a glimpse of a possibility which speaks to Advent hope in all its elusive glory. Edwin Muir was based in a village near Cambridge when he died, and he's buried in the graveyard there in leafy Swaffham Prior. The epitaph on his grave reads, "His unblinded eyes saw far and near the fields of paradise." On this St. Andrew's Day, the first Sunday in Advent, may we see through his eyes something of the promise of paradise, the very kingdom of heaven, both far and near.
His holy covenant.
That beautiful setting of a poem of hope from the opening chapter of Luke's Gospel was composed by the Scot, Sir James Macmillan, whose music joins with words spoken by students in prayer.
God of hope, as we enter the season of longing for this world to be transformed, we pray for places where so many people are experiencing darkness. Those suffering from violence and war in the Middle East, Sudan, Ukraine, and elsewhere, people affected by changes in climate and the turning of the seasons, all in our own communities struggling to see the way forward, all affected by illness, loss, and bereavement. Come to us in your peace, we pray.
Inspiring God, we pray for all who work with words, storytellers, poets, and novelists who reflect on your love in our world with integrity and imagination. In their creativity, may we find new insight, challenge, and comfort. Come to us with your beauty, we pray.
Faithful God, may all who follow your Son, Jesus Christ, encouraged by the example of St. Andrew, bring enthusiasm, joy, and patience to our lives, sharing our hope in your loving presence throughout Advent and beyond. Come to us in your love, we pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Our final song is a poem exploring the hope of Advent in metaphors from nature. Soil beneath the frost line, diamond brilliance of stars through darkness, and the presence of Christ in the lonely, the stranger, and the outcast. Now the heavens start to whisper.
Thank you.
Eternal God, our hearts desire the warmth of your love, and our minds search for the light of your word. Increase our longing for Christ our Saviour, and give us the strength to grow in love, that the dawn of his coming may find us rejoicing in his presence and welcoming the light of his truth. O God, the source of all insight, whose coming was revealed to the nations not among men of power, but on a woman's lap, give us grace to seek you where you may be found, that the wisdom of this world may be humbled, and we discover your unexpected joy. Go in the hope of God, and the blessing of God Almighty, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit be with you this Advent and evermore.
Carry On Sortie by Henri Mulet, bringing to a close Sunday worship, which came live from St. Salvator's Chapel in the University of St. Andrews and was presented by the chaplain, the Reverend Dr. Donald McEwen, and the Reverend Professor Alison Jack of Edinburgh University's School of Divinity. The chapel choir was directed by Claire Innes Hopkins, and the organists were Callum Landon and Daniel Toombs. The producer was Mo McCulloch. And next week, Sunday Worship's Advent author is Dylan Thomas and comes from Swansea.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What?
Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Now, witness history with Rachel Naylor, who's taking us back to communist Czechoslovakia.
It's the 11th of September, 1951, and we're in Nymburk, a town 50 kilometres east of the capital Prague. And it's a big day for 23-year-old Karl Rummel.
The date was set. You know, I had no way of backing out of it. I had to catch this train. And the horrible thing was to make a decision not to tell anybody, because ignorance was the best defense, knowing full well that eventually something would come out with my name on it, and that those people would be interrogated. But I couldn't leave without saying goodbye to Mum.
After bidding her farewell, Karl made his way to Prague station. There, he boarded the 9:55 a.m. State Railways Express train number 3717 to Heb, a town in the west of Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic.
It was a very touching experience because I was looking at all the farms, the towns, the villages, beautiful countryside, knowing full well that it was forever.
At 2:12 p.m., the train arrived in Heb and divided. Three carriages proceeded onto Ash, a small town 25 kilometres to the north. Carl stayed on board, alongside lots of passengers who were on their way home from Hebb Grammar School or the famous Frantisch Kovilas near Spa.
A railroad officer, his name was Carl Tuxa, came to me and said, "You're Carl Romo?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know what you're supposed to do." You know, because people sitting all around, you know. I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "Good luck." And I said, "Good luck to you too."
At the train's penultimate stop, Haslov, that officer who was a signaller, and the train driver, Yaroslav Kombalinka, bled the air out of the emergency brakes, meaning they could no longer be used. Only the handbrakes in the carriages remained functional. The next part of the plan involved a railway junction. Ahead of Ash, there was a set of points, which on certain days allowed freight trains carrying coal to switch onto a track which led to West Germany, now Germany, and it wouldn't immediately be switched back. Now was their chance. The train set off again. But it didn't stop at Ash like it was supposed to.
It was quite obvious that we were gathering speed and the whole thing was in danger of exploding. There were people waiting there at the station. I could just see the eyes open like this because we hit that station going full speed. And just continued out.
This was Carl's cue. He got to his feet and went to guard the handbrake.
I was just pretending to be, stretching and being inconspicuous. A really obese uniform headed for me for the brake. He sort of tried to push me aside physically. By this time, of course, I had the gun in my hand, so I just simply stuck it in his fat stomach. I was trying to see what was going outside, but all I had in front of me was the face of hate. The breath smelled of beer, onion, and a sausage which was called Wurst. He was a godsend because he kept me covered from his buddies behind him in the aisle who would have loved to throw me to pieces.
By the time the other border guards realised what was going on, it was too late. At 3:10 p.m, the train crossed the border, coming to a stop about 500 metres into West Germany.
Instead of doing something to hurt me, he just slams that door open, jumps out, and two or three of his buddies right behind him, and they're jogging up the hill back to the border. They had to know who I was because they could see the gun, but they were all cowards. They were guardians, you know, of a police state. Therefore, out of their territory, their bravery left them.
Carl was now in a zone occupied by Americans, which was established by the Allies at the end of World War II.
There was not a soul, nobody. The Iron Curtain was to keep the people from escaping. It was just amazing to me because, you know, the papers were full of the reasons for the borders being fortified, you know, to keep away the possible invasion of the West, you know. Along this dirt track comes this Jeep. In the Jeep are two German customs officers and two GIs. And the first thing is that, who speaks English here? So I said, I do a little. So he said, what's going on? So I tried to explain. He just laughed and sort of patted me on the back. A good show. And then he told me to tell the engineer to continue on to the next station called Selb. We felt safe finally.
At the station, 34 of those on board decided they wanted to stay in West Germany, including Carl, the other hijackers and their families, and three members of the Czech armed forces.
The next thing I remember was a ride in the back of an army truck to Straubing, which is a very pretty town on the river. And we were lodged in very nice, large private homes, like bed and breakfast type thing, introduced to the officer dealing with me. An American soldier of Czech descent, bilingual, from all places, Puerto Rico. It looked like my hero, Glenn Miller. Very, very nice. So that was the end of a very eventful day.
I'll say. The escape was dubbed the Freedom Train by Western media.
Germany, and a train running from Prague to Asch near the West German border, gate crashed through the border into Western Germany and freedom. When arrested by German police for illegally crossing the frontier, The driver said that life behind the Iron Curtain was intolerable, while the rest of the passengers take a return ticket to Czechoslovakia. But those who chose freedom seemed very pleased at the prospect.
Including Carl. But it wasn't time to celebrate his freedom just yet.
The perpetrators were to undergo sort of a mock trial. The Germans had to pretend that they sort of dealt with us. The American officer saying, don't worry about it. You know, if we even suspected that the judge has any sympathies with the East, we wouldn't let them take you. So we were taken to the court in Nuremberg. And I don't even remember whether we were even given a warning or anything. From that point on, we were free.
But that wasn't the case for everyone. Of the 111 people on board the train, most were unaware they were going to escape that day. 77 decided to return to Czechoslovakia and were taken to face state security, the Státní bezpečnost, or STB. The communist regime reported that citizens had been kidnapped on a train by a terrorist gang led by an American agent. But from the 26th of September, 10,000 balloons carrying 8 million leaflets were launched as part of a campaign organised by Radio Free Europe with the aim of telling Czechs the true story.
The train escaped with such a black eye for the communists. Stalin apparently was so furious that several very high-ranking commies in the Czech Republic lost their jobs and even ended up in prison. What they wanted to do was to very quickly punish the perpetrators of this crime against People's Republic and also discourage others of following in our footsteps.
Witness history and the story of the Czech Freedom Train, told by Rachel Naylor using an archive interview with Karel Rummel. For more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, just search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Paddy O'Connell will be here with Broadcasting House shortly, and then the wildlife cameraman and presenter Gordon Buchanan will be sharing the 8 tracks, book and luxury item he'd take with him if cast away. Desert Island Discs is at 10. But first, a BBC Audio Bristol production for Radio 4, produced by Joe PC. It's Tweet of the Day with Francis Tophill.
The seashore has always been my home. But the sound that's followed me from the stony beaches of my childhood on the Kent coast to my favourite swim spots in Devon, where I now live, is the call of the turnstone. These communal creatures waddle in groups at considerable speed along the harder surfaces of the coastline. Rock, cliff and concrete, searching for food under rocks. Turnstones mainly visit UK coastlines in winter, when their plumage is unremarkable, dull brown and speckled, with a white underbelly and orange legs. Their summer colours are warm chestnut, but something I have rarely seen. When I'm called to the sea, as I regularly am, to sit, swim or walk under big skies and flat views, these little creatures often join me. They swoop in and run just ahead,